Simon & Schuster Audio presents I Think I'm Outta Here, a memoir of all my families, written and read by Carol O'Connor.
San Francisco, October the 1st, 1997. Looking out of my window in the Clift Hotel in San Francisco, I made up my mind about the meaning of the title of this memoir. What it meant when I first thought of it was nothing in particular, and I chose it knowing that for anyone of 73, out of here would sooner or later have to mean something. I would cull out a meaning in due course. And now I had it. It meant out of the theater. My play, entitled A Certain Labor Day, had opened in San Francisco a week before, and the man the San Francisco Chronicle pays to kill new plays killed it. He hated it. Hated the sets, the direction, the acting, the plot, in brief, the very thought of it. The plot, I should explain, was not what he was told it was going to be. In the arts section of his own paper, in a cover article, with a front page, full page photo of me, he had read a week before opening that the play was autobiographical, with emphasis on my son's drug problem. The play about an old New York labor union official had nothing to do with me or my son. The reviewer was unable to recover from his confusion. He wrote that the play was not what it was supposed to be, and panned it. The people he sways, evidently most of his readers, declined to buy tickets, and the play died. What also died was my interest in theater. The radio stations and a couple of suburban papers gave us rave notices, but the Chronicle thug beat me bow-legged. I knew I was going to leave my money, but not my heart, in San Francisco. My howl over the demented assault in San Francisco might have been left for later. But I said to myself, put it up front. It's a vengeful and ignoble outburst and reveals what you really like, you queer memoirist. A fellow who, discarding one enviable triumph, aspires to others and lashes out at whoever refuses to praise him. You better expose yourself at the start. Reveal that your triumphant self stands on feet of clay. People are going to glean it anyway. They always do. Thus exposed, I feel I can begin, relying on sympathy and understanding and trusting that in my misshapen mental condition, I am not entirely alone. Above all, keep it light. That was my wife Nancy's warning on hearing that I was going to write an autobiography. You're not at your best, she told me, when you get too serious. You've been too serious on a couple of those talk shows. You disappoint people. They expect you to be entertaining. I know, I said, leaving the bedroom. Just keep it light, she trilled. I'm not getting the book out today, I called back. Play down the politics and the anger. People much prefer to know about all the fun you've had. I was on the stairs. Her words were at my heels. But, of course, when it comes to my advice, you seldom listen. I pressed an intercom button near the kitchen door. I always listen. I seldom reply. Silence. She was postponing her response. She was aware that corroded wires in the kitchen speaker made everybody sound ridiculous. She did not want to sound ridiculous. Sometime during the 50s, I read an actor's autobiography, Errol Flynn's, and loved it. It was full of fun, an unblushing confession of marvelous outrages, and I envied it because it was the kind of story I knew I wasn't able to write about myself. What could I tell that would be half so entertaining? What, for instance, about sex and love, topics large in the Flynn book and requisite to success in all biographies of no consequence? I married once, so did my wife in 1951, and the marriage was still happy and promising, untroubled by supplemental relationships or disagreeable surprises. My life had not been dull, but it was a chain of events that did not glitter even for me. I was thinking about all this because of Jimmy Cagney. Jimmy's was the next actor's autobiography I read, and it differed from Flynn's as a glow in the hearth from a fire in the rafters. Jimmy wrote a life that was hard and professionally painful, yet not without fun. I thought that if I could arrive somewhere in that neighborhood, I might do a book sometime. I suddenly wanted to begin my book. I recall a surge of enthusiasm, but it soon subsided. How was I to begin? Who was I, anyway? Did I know? I asked myself that question until I got tired of it. And one day the question was asked of me by a pretty blonde woman who, with a friend, a pretty brunette, was looking at me across a luncheon table. "Do you know who you are?" I was thinking about a response, but the brunette preempted me. She said, "Of course he does. He knows exactly who he is." I smiled at her and looked back at the blonde, who shrugged. She would have preferred the answer from me. I was not acquainted with these ladies. They had won me in a raffle. Or rather, their winning tickets had entitled them to a lunch with me at my Beverly Hills restaurant. I said to the brunette, "Funny you should think I know exactly who I am. If I knew, I could start writing about it." "An autobiography?" said the brunette. The blonde shook her head and said very seriously, "You can't tell who you are in an autobiography. Who you are, that's not to write about. It's just for you to know." "And he knows," said the brunette. "He knows exactly. I know he knows." She knew I knew. What did she mean by that? My face is a sphere on which little, least of all, apprehension may hide, and the brunette hastened to put me at ease. "Of course I have no personal knowledge," she said, "only psychic." I relaxed. Nothing psychic ever alarms me. "Exactly what is a book?" interposed the blonde. She did not wait for the answer I was trying to form. She said, "A book is just a bunch of events from when you were born up to whenever. But the past can't tell anybody who you are, because the past is not who you are. Who you are has nothing to do with any of that. It's about right now, today, and no other day matters." This kind of talk was not unfamiliar. It was, during that decade of the 70s, the kind of talk one often heard at trendy but goofy parties in the Hollywood Hills. Whatever you happened to be was wonderful. Whatever you happened to know was more than enough. And if you had been conned into believing this by some self-realization guru, you could fancy yourself a savant, regardless of the debris or vacuity of your past. You could feel whole and worthy right now. The brunette said, "My friend is right. Change is always going on, and people and things get better all the time. I'm an optimist," she giggled. The blonde smiled tolerantly to imply, I think, that her friend's comprehension was characteristically in arrears. "The word better," she softly advised, "is really not useful." And that was about all there was to that, but the point of the story is that the encounter put me off stride. I stopped working on the book. However, I soon got my first chance to write something about myself. In 1983, and again in 1984, I failed on Broadway, but press agents for those two unlucky shows had asked me for a biographical sketch. I wrote one, and they used some of it in Playbill, the theater program for the plays. Here is that sketch for the convenience of the hurried reader, say a talk show host who wants to know something about me, but not much. About Carol O'Connor. He has won 5 Emmy Awards and the Peabody Award for television acting. 4 were for comedy acting. The TV Academy later gave him a 5th Emmy for dramatic acting in the series In the Heat of the Night. He attended the University of Montana, but earned his degree in history and English at University College Dublin, UCD, the main branch of Ireland's National University. While still a UCD undergraduate, he began acting professionally in a company formed by the Irish playwright Lennox Robinson. The company played the Edinburgh Festival of Drama in 1951 and later performed on BBC television in London. This was O'Connor's first appearance in the medium that 20 years afterward made him known throughout the world. He joined in 1951 the internationally famous Dublin Gate Theatre Company, and in 1953 another Irish company formed by the actor-manager Cyril Cusack. In 1955 he returned to the University of Montana to obtain an M.A. O'Connor appeared on the New York stage and in London and Paris in a renowned production of James Joyce's Ulysses, adapted and directed by Burgess Meredith. He acted in a number of important television dramas in New York and was invited to Hollywood in 1960 by Warner Brothers. Up to 1971, he acted in 26 motion pictures, the best known being A Fever of the Blood, Lonely of the Brave, Cleopatra, Hawaii, Point Blank, Waterhole No. 3, In Harm's Way, and Kelly's Heroes. One of his several TV movies was his own adaptation of The Last Hurrah for Hallmark. He is, of course, best known for the television series All in the Family. The O'Connors have a son, Hugh, born in Rome in 1962 while Cleopatra was being filmed, and Italy is the home from home they love best. They live in the Brentwood section of Los Angeles in a house built in 1926 for the opera singer Amelita Galicorci. Now, why did I mention Galicorci? Not out of pretentiousness, though that flaw is not strange to me, because the name of the great diva would not impress the impressionable today, and her house, situated in the neighborhood of sidewalks and pleasant homes near the UCLA campus, is not a famous place like Pickfair, the sumptuous home built by the actors Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks in Beverly Hills. What then compelled me? I was contemplating my first Broadway play, and I was at my mother's house, the house where I grew up in Forest Hills, browsing through a cabinet of sheet music published during the 20s and 30s. I had a recollection of my father operating the Victrola and announcing the performing artists whose names were on the old 78 RPM record labels, and I fancied I again heard his voice pronouncing with pleasure the names Martinelli, Caruso, Galicorci, and informing us about the legendary soprano. No one ever sang Caro Norme like that. She was peerless. About things like that, my father was always right. I am given to involuntary murmurings, and I heard myself saying audibly, he was always right. My mother was in the room, and she said, "What was that?" "Nothing." "You said he was always right. Who?" "My father," I replied. She laughed. "Easy now." "I know," I said, "I know. I suppose he was always wrong, really. That's more like it. But he was always right, too." She said, "You'll have to explain that to me sometime." "Okay," I said, "sometime." Whether or not my father lived a life of correctitude is another matter, and I will come to it, but my bringing Galicorci into the program note brought my father, in my fancy, to Broadway with me. He loved Broadway. He would have loved to see me there. He's long gone. He died in 1967. My mother died the 1st of January, 1994, and, as I write, the house with the sun porch that served as a music room stands vacant. She used to play the piano in that room and he the violin on Sundays after church, and I grew up hearing not only classical music, but the world repertoire of popular theater music, from Herbert, Romberg, and Kern to Porter, Gershwin, and Rogers. They both sang very well. A happy pair and most unhappy. A merry house and very sad. A man who is always right and always wrong. I saw the light of day in Manhattan. They brought me newborn from St. Anne's Maternity Hospital in East 67th Street to an apartment in the borough of the Bronx at 168th Street in the Grand Concourse, then considered a fine neighborhood. And we lived there till I was about four. My recollections of the place are of two misdeeds and the punishments I got for them. The first was defiantly climbing a gate into the forbidden premises of a nearby synagogue, being ejected and chased and finally walloped on the behind by a girl known as a maid, our maid. The second was torturing this girl with matches until she retaliated by dangling me by the ankles down a dumbwaiter shaft. The poor girl got fired when I calmly squealed on her. Her scare tactic had not troubled me in the least, but I knew that a report of it would evoke panic in my mother, which was always interesting to watch. When my brother Hugh was born in 1929, we moved to a larger apartment in Elmhurst in the borough of Queens. I was five and too young to be admitted to public school, but my mother demonstrated to the principal of PS 89 that I had learned to read and write at home to something of an adult level, that is, of at least the sixth grade, which meant that I could read any New York newspaper. I did so for the principal. She judged me instantly to be a genius, admitted me to the first grade without detention in kindergarten, and thence quickly on to the second grade where everybody might be more comfortable with me. Thereafter I became impossible to teach, and nobody was comfortable with me. I once conducted a casual survey to find whether something between my ears had gone awry as I passed from age 4 to 8. My friends could recall many wonderful events, and this disturbed me because of my years in Elmhurst I could recall so little. I do recall doing my very first acting at that time, my first character work, not for a school play but for the entertainment of my Elmhurst neighbors. We were living on Britton Avenue, and round the corner on Forley Street there were some houses with open porches, where men sat in their undershirts on summer evenings drinking Prohibition near beer, and yelling across narrow driveways in good-natured argument whether or not Schmeling would take Sharkey, Hoover would win a second term, Lindy's baby had been kidnapped by the mob. I used to sit on the running boards of parked cars and listen to the ribald language and the funny accents and wait to be offered a treat by any of the women, all of whom seemed constantly to be making and serving cake. In return, I was obliged to entertain the ladies with an imitation of one or another of the men, and my performances always got howling approval. One night, or very early morning, one of those open porches where I gave my award-winning skits was blown away by an explosive missile of some sort, well-pitched, everyone agreed, from a moving car. I had been awakened by the sound, and so had neighbors several blocks from it. The house itself, when we all went to look at it, appeared undamaged. It just looked oddly unfinished without its porch. "Who did that?" I asked my father. "Some gentleman in the spirits business," he said. "Racketeers," Minnie, our nanny, said, and shook her head. A boy standing beside me said, "Racketeers is what the lousy bohunks call us Italians." "Isn't it the mercy of God they didn't harm any of the people in there?" said Minnie. "I would say they didn't intend to harm anybody," my father said. "Then why did they do it?" I asked. "To show they could," he said, "for reasons that shouldn't interest us." I overheard the superintendent of our building saying, "That's what the wops bring to this country, bombs and bump-offs." I asked Minnie what wops meant, but she kept silent. When I asked her what bohunks were, she nodded at the superintendent. She was wrong. I learned that the super was a Swede, and that the appropriately insulting name for him was Squarehead. We moved again in 1933 when my father and mother bought their first and only house in Forest Hills, and there I finished the 8 years of my elementary schooling. Whatever the subject class, I spent the time making phantasmagoric drawings in a copybook, watching the clock on the wall, engaging my classmates in distracting talk, and infuriating the teacher. Both my younger brothers, Hugh and Robert, became physicians, and I, of course, wandered into a business where the undisciplined are welcome. Forest Hills was in those days real suburbia. It was beautiful. There lived the rich, the near rich, the well-to-do, and the comfortable. I had heard a real estate sales agent say to my father, "This is a premium neighborhood." "What's the premium?" my father asked. "No Jews," said the agent. A lie. In fact, there were as many Jews in Forest Hills as anywhere else. When my father related this incident to Jules Kahn, his law partner, Kahn's burst of laughter actually expelled his cigar. "Your face and name," he howled at my father, "made him think you'd be happy to hear that." I asked why, and my father explained, "We Irish Catholics are widely assumed to be unfriendly to Jews." "Why?" I asked again. "Because you are," laughed Kahn. "Jules is clowning," my father said, but he did not say that Jules was dissembling. Obviously, the real estate agent thought that anti-Jewishness was popular enough to be a winning sales pitch. My father's sour reaction to him was undetectable, though of course I sensed it, but at age 9 I didn't question his apparently passive attitude to bigotry. I recalled it to him years later, and he replied that he was never a reformer, he could not have re-educated the man. He said, "Rather than warn him about dangerous waters, I preferred to let him swim confidently toward the falls." I told this to someone who said, "Your old man was copping out." Maybe. I didn't think so. You have to be afraid of something to cop out, and I don't think my father was ever afraid of anything at all. He was simply above ethnic and religious preconceptions, never emotional about prejudice, but always quietly mocking. "It's all lowbrow," was the comment I remember best. I have never known a hater with a reliable intelligence. My father had a legal practice. He was a criminal lawyer, a trial lawyer. In later years, I had occasion to meet one or two of the high-living incorrigibles who paid him large fees to keep them untrammeled. He was also in business. He had an interest in a popular adult school that prepared candidates for various civil service examinations. He had plenty of money. My mother was an earner, too. A public school teacher when she married, she helped put my father through New York University Law School and continued working in the school system for 30 years until retirement. For kids, there was a bonanza of open fields within and around Forest Hills. Flat fields for ball playing in summer and hilly for sledding in winter. Baseball was the passion of our neighborhood gang, and in season our team played on weekends against teams from Rego Park, Richmond Hill, Elmhurst, and Corona. We played against ourselves on weekdays. I knew the roster of every team in the National League and most in the American, and the batting and pitching averages of the players, and I understood game strategy. I also wanted to be a sports writer like Dan Parker of the Mirror and a writer of stories and novels. Why I did not want to be an actor, too, makes me wonder, because nothing, not even baseball, gave me greater pleasure than the movies. I suppose a movie career seemed too utterly unattainable. The movies were a realm of miracles where only someone himself miraculous might enter. The Depression was not apparent in Forest Hills. The poor didn't live there. And the poor who worked there were not visible, coming by trolley and jalopy from ragged regions elsewhere and disappearing into their jobs. You had to go to Manhattan to see soup and bread lines. In 1936, the economy tumbled into a deep slough. For years afterward, the professional thinkers were at pains to explain the misfortune as merely another one of those panics. The fault of individuals of heedless ambition, lapsed integrity, faint heart in the face of peril. Nothing to blame the American system for. Still in the 30s, men like Archie Bunker were looking at each other and saying, "What's the answer? Has Roosevelt got the answer? Who's got the answer?" In those days, Scott Fitzgerald's very rich, a small minority, lived farther out on Long Island in Nassau and the Suffolk counties. I remember asking my grandfather, John Carroll O'Connor, for whom I was named, how people managed to become very rich. And he said they were only a minority, but they did it while the great majority were looking the other way. They got control of resources and built industries. The majority preferred to draw wages and amuse themselves. My grandfather, a Republican who had run in Manhattan for Congress and lost in a Democratic district, had a higher respect for the minority than the majority. To this, my father added that the rich meanwhile observed that in order to stay rich and get richer, they had to run the government. They dedicated themselves to plotting and scheming, creating a government that would devote itself to the well-being of private industry, act as the business agent for commercial enterprise, invent policies domestic and foreign that promised profit to the profit-makers, opposed taxation to pay for publicly owned, public interest, non-profit enterprise. My grandfather, being rich, shared the view of the rich that if private enterprise thrives, so will its dependents, the ordinary people and the poor, except, of course, a certain fragment of the poor known as the chronic poor. "Ah, the chronic poor," exclaimed my father in mock lament. "The rich man looks at the chronic poor and recalls the words of the Lord who said of them that they will always be with us, which the rich man understands to mean that he needn't worry about them." My grandfather laughed and didn't argue the point. A war was coming, and at 16 I did not want to be denied a war, presuming it would be as thrilling as the movies made it. Most of the boys in our crowd were of the same mind. The First World War movies of the 30s, like The Dawn Patrol, starring Errol Flynn, made us long to fly fighter planes and shoot vicious-looking Germans out of the skies. Most exciting to me in those days were the pulp magazines about flying aces of the First World War. War on foot was not much romanticized in fiction magazines because it was muddy, bloody, and proximately deadly, and it seemed old-fashioned anyway. To the big military minds, this impending Second World War was going to be fought and won in the air. As it turned out, the war would finally be won like all other wars, on the grisly ground through appalling human sacrifice. The male Sears in my family, thought that the big French army and the British Expeditionary Force were capable of stopping Hitler. I asked my grandfather, and when they stop him, the war will stop? Yes. What about going all the way and beating him? Not necessary was the answer to that, which I then referred to Mr. Greenberg at the candy store, who was of the same mind. We were standing in front of his store beside the large newsstand. Mr. Slatkin was there, too. Mr. Grillo the barber was there. If they stop him, said Greenberg, the war will stop. They'll all sit down again and handle some more. Hitler will keep what he already got and promise everybody that the next person he attacks, it'll be Stalin. And maybe the Allies will say, yeah, and then they'll all go and knock off Uncle Joe. Mr. Slatkin, who always stood near the newsstand reading the Jewish Daily Forward, said, ha! He worked for the Forward and liked passers-by to know that it was available right there at Greenberg's. He was well known for his interjections into any conversation that might be going on around him. He said his ha with contempt, but as he never took his eyes off the paper, no one was sure that his usually harsh comments were not about what he was reading. There was an often told story about his saying bullshit into his paper when his real target was a policeman who was loudly maintaining that goldfish and birds ought to be licensed like dogs and cats. Mr. Grillo intervened. That's what they ought to do now, smash Stalin, and we ought to help them. Should we, I asked Mr. Greenberg. Nah, we should mind our own business. Communism ain't our business, repeated Mr. Grillo in a suddenly fierce voice. It ain't mine, Mr. Greenberg coolly replied, and he lit a fresh lucky strike from the burning end of the one he was smoking. He stared calmly at the slightly quivering barber, and the latter, his face quite red, turned and strode away. Mr. Slatkin grumbled, Meshuggene, into the Forward. In fact, I see two Meshugganes. Mr. Greenberg directed a small raspberry at Mr. Slatkin. So anyway, I said to Mr. Greenberg, we wouldn't have a chance to get into it, right? Surprised, he asked. You want to get into it? Sure, I said. But Mr. Greenberg knew I was thinking about something exciting and glamorous and safe. And he looked at me and said in a weary voice, don't be a jerk. He turned and went into his store, and I turned to follow him because I was worried about his losing respect for me. Mr. Slatkin addressed me by staring into his paper. Schools shouldn't close in the summer. I had once heard Mr. Slatkin telling the inside of the Forward that schools should allow 3-day weekends, but no long vacations. Germany invaded Poland in June 1939. For many months, nothing else of military importance happened, and our press during the fall and winter reported that the man in the street was calling it the phony war. At last, in the spring of 1940, the world got the war it was waiting for. Big German armies suddenly moved by air, land, and sea and occupied Holland and Denmark. They defeated Norway and France and were standing on the Spanish frontier. At school, one of my teachers instructed us that the French were a contemptible people, and that the British, though much finer human types, had been finished off at Dunkirk. Hitler would be in London by the end of the summer. Another teacher said that by the end of the summer the Italians would drive the British out of all Africa. Fascist Spain would drive the British out of Gibraltar. Communist Russia would first invade Sweden, and then the whole Balkan Peninsula, including Greece. By the end of the summer these terrible movements had not been accomplished, or even attempted. I was mystified. If teachers did not know what was going to happen, who did? Were my teachers nitwits? Yes, a few. Most were intelligent men and women who religiously garnered information from the papers and the news and opinion journals of the day. But they were routinely misinformed. They relied on the press, and the press, true to form, not really knowing much, misled them. It was well known that in Germany and the occupied countries, Hitler was turning an ancient chronic sickness, Jew-hating, into a national policy. Some American and French and British leaders deplored Hitler's racism, took note of his harassment of all dissenting religious opinion, but no one suggested opposing him with sanctions or force. President Roosevelt went so far as to ask Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister, to mention to the Führer at Munich the concern of our government over the fate of German Jews. That is all. Few in this world besides the Jews said more. When the Japanese attacked our Navy in Hawaii, I was sojourning profitlessly at Wake Forest College in the state of North Carolina, at that time a small men's liberal arts college conjoined with the seminary for Baptist ministerial students. A curious whereabouts for the likes of me, but it will, I trust, be accounted for by the following. The Seaboard Railroad had a depot in Wake Forest, and my mother and I stepped down from a slow-moving passenger train late in August 1941. I had been an obstreperous nuisance in all my high school years. It had taken three schools to graduate me, and I had battled my mother over everything she ever wanted to do for me except one, teach me to dance. Only at dances could I get my arms around girls without resistance. But I paid attention to her when she warned me that if I did not get some good grades in my final high school year, no college would let me in. Even so, my mother told me she would have to come down to Wake Forest with me to persuade the dean that three bad years and one good year deserved, in my case, serious consideration. Somehow I knew how to sound plausibly like a genius, so Mama and I, a pair of city slickers, put one over on the kindly dean. However, having got myself in, I now suddenly wanted to get out. An ill-considered impulse had brought me to a place where I really did not want to be. I marshaled a few false-hearted pleas to return immediately to New York. My ghost and my dibble were there with me, or I should say in me. I'll soon explain these invisible lifelong companions. And the ghost said, "If you seriously tell your ma the truth, that you're simply unready and afraid, she might take you home." But the dibble argued, "Why would a brave young lad of 17 tell his ma a pitiful thing like that?" The ghost replied, "To protect her, for it'll go hard with her when he fails." "It won't surprise her," laughed the devil. "She's used to his failings." The remark was not funny, it was harsh, but it was true. I wish even today that I had been the kind of kid who gave some thought to making his mother happy. 4 months later, on the day after the country learned about Pearl Harbor, I was malingering at the Wake Forest Rail Depot listening to the philosophers that gathered there most afternoons or early evenings. The circle comprised, besides a telegrapher, a ticket agent, and a shipping clerk, a veterinarian, a warehouse owner, a car parts dealer, a man who had a part-time county job, and usually someone like me, a stray student, never women or girls. We gentlemen, notwithstanding our proclaimed enterprises, were essentially idlers. The elders were talking about the war the Japanese had just launched against us. They believed, like nearly everybody else in America, that the Japanese were a naturally inferior nation, and that their navy was as insubstantial as the products of their toy factories, which could be seen on the counters of American dime stores everywhere. The Japanese were denigrated as pilferers of Western ideas, nothing more. The gentlemen assured each other that our navy would blow theirs instantly out of the water. They did not know at that moment that Japanese aircraft had yesterday sunk the best part of our Pacific fleet. The telegraphy man offered the intelligence that Jap cities were not only shacks but also grass huts, hardly worth the shells of our dreadnoughts, much more cheaply destroyed with matches. I remained in Wake Forest until the spring of 1942, then left before the end of the term, having wasted my freshman year. I busied myself at my grandfather's office running errands, and then got a job as a copy boy on the New York Times. In August, at 18, I decided to volunteer for the Naval Air Corps because it was romantically deadly. But Naval Air rejected me. My mother was relieved, but her sister, my Aunt Jo, suggested that my habitually careless appearance might have distressed the flawless Navy men in Lower Manhattan, and that I ought to fix myself up decently and try again. But in Philadelphia, my mother told her to be still. Americans were telling each other that they were ready to fight. Few felt that we had a good reason to fight a European war, but a war with Japan was a different case. Americans felt in 1939 that England and France were wicked and degenerate and had brought the war on themselves. The anti-war grumblings I remember hearing everywhere identified our real enemies as Wall Street, the capitalists, the communists, the interests, or the Jews. Our press had criticized Germany in measured terms, but had freely condemned Japan. The Japanese attack was described to the world as a surprise, though it could hardly have surprised us, coming more than a year after General Marshall first warned Hawaiian commands to prepare for it. The United States Merchant Marine Academy had set up a midshipman program, and I was accepted into it. For the basic training, I was sent to a rather pretty station at the edge of the Gulf Coast town of Pass Christian, Mississippi. I remember the town only as the place where the bus stopped on the way to New Orleans. The old quarter of New Orleans offered what it had always offered, uproarious merriment. Bars, clubs, jazz bands, good restaurants for every purse. And in the genteel part of town, tea dances at the Hotel Roosevelt, attended by exceedingly beautiful girls from Tulane University. I had the time of my life, and wished that New Orleans might be my home port, in spite of rumors that the Germans were sinking ships just off the Delta. My home port for a while was to be New York. Basic training over, I was ordered aboard a ship with a regular run between the Brooklyn Army Base and the ports of Swansea, Cardiff, and Newport in England's Bristol Channel. I should say here that before leaving Pass Christian for sea duty, I was warned by officer instructors that my attitude needed improvement. My attitude toward what? Toward everything. I was still a bad student. My first ship out of New York was a large, unusual freighter named SS Sea Train Lakehurst. In peacetime, she had carried loaded freight trains from Caribbean fruit depots to rail terminals in New Jersey. Now her four long decks were ideal for shipping tanks, weapons carriers, armored cars, trucks and jeeps, and appropriate army personnel to man them. Everyone but me sailed her with taut nerves. I was not brave, just silly. There seemed little to be concerned about. The Lakehurst traveled in troopship convoys, protected by cruisers and destroyers, and even on one crossing a battleship. And on her own she was faster than most submarines, having a twin-screw high-pressure turbine plant that drove her to a speed of 22 knots. However, having no watertight compartments, she was uniquely vulnerable to any hole the enemy might make in her hull. She would have plunged swiftly. I sailed on the North Atlantic aboard the Lakehurst during the entire winter of 1943. My failure to be concerned about studying, to complete a certain sea project, books of homework assignments, caused the Merchant Marine Academy to decide I was unfit to continue officer training after my sea tour. As the chief engineer of the Lakehurst, a salty old Texan, reported, "He's as useless as tits on a bull." I shed the Academy uniform and took and easily passed exams given by the Coast Guard for accreditation to sail in all steam engine rooms as an oiler or a fireman water tender. I joined the National Maritime Union and shipped out of the hiring hall as a civilian seaman. I sailed in engine rooms until 1945 as an oiler on ore ships to Trinidad and Cuba, and on several freighters to Italy, France, and North Africa. An oiler, I should explain, stands watch below with an engineer and assists the engineer in a general way. The rest of my seagoing experience was a purser, making a number of voyages to France and Yugoslavia and Japan. The job was fairly cushy. A purser was responsible for all the paperwork incident to the ship's business. In the fall of 1946, I returned to Jacksonville, Florida, settled affairs on my ship, and went to New York, to my mother's house in Forest Hills. I was at loose ends. With the war over, deck officers had taken their opportunity to strike against all American flag companies. I had no ship to go to. I relaxed at home. Days went by, then weeks, and I never again boarded a ship as a working seaman. In 1943, I had met a girl in New York who came from the state of Montana. In August of that year, when I had become 19, Loretta had become 23. We had fallen in love and remained in love, but with lengthy separations, for the next 4 years. In 1947, the war being over, we got together again with marriage in mind. We lived for a time at my mother's house in Forest Hills. In New York, I was working for my mother's sister, Pearl, who was running The Advocate, the Irish weekly paper her father, my grandfather, had founded in 1893. My grandfather had died, and Aunt Pearl needed my help for a while. There was very little money in this, and Loretta couldn't see where it was leading anyway. Neither could I. She went back to Chinook, and I soon followed her. I lived for a time with Loretta and her family in the tiny northern Montana town of Chinook. Her mother Lillian and her grandmother ran a general store, and I helped them in the hardware department. They were rich people in terms of land and commercial holdings. They drew their largest income from ranches out on the prairies and commercial spaces in the town. But they were the kind of people who liked to keep personally busy at one small enterprise and another. They knew that as Loretta's husband, if ever I maneuvered my way into that situation, and they earnestly hoped I would be diverted, I could bumble around their premises indefinitely, but they knew well that their restless only child would not long tolerate a third-rate social situation in this wind-blown town on the Milk River. Loretta's mother thought our parting was the most truly loving thing we ever did for one another. Loretta and I parted with wet faces and choking admissions that this wrenching moment was the worst of our lives. We had always wanted passionately to be together from the first hour of our meeting, but we were never confident of making a go of things. Now, at 24, I had absolutely no professional prospect in front of me, nor even a wish for one, only a dreamy intention of writing things one day. I was, and knew I was, as palpable a specimen of inadequacy as a girl then 28 could imagine. We both, of course, fell in love again with someone else, and happily proceeded into lasting marriages. Loretta's mother persuaded me to remain in Montana and enroll in the state university at Missoula, with a view toward a degree in English and journalism. I resumed at last the formal education I so pitifully began at Wake Forest. But I want now to tell a sea story. About those voices I referred to, those Irish spirits within me, I mentioned them earlier. One of them is a ghost. Whose? I do not know. The other is a devil. He's very much a low-class creature given to grumblings and tauntings and teasings, and he is not deeply influential. Let me give you some idea of what I mean. When in late 1943 I first saw Ireland, my ship had arrived in the early morning at the mouth of Lough Foyle and had stopped. I must here swear that the fabled green of Ireland is no fable. It is indeed green, like the emerald, a startling green in the dewy morning before the sun gilds it. The ghost whispered to me, "That is Ireland looking at you, boy, our home. We may allow ourselves a few tears." Being alone on deck, we did. But the devil happened to be also in brief residence, and no sooner had I cleared my emotion with a nose rag than he piped up, "Swim over." "What's that?" I snapped. He giggled at my irritation and said again, "Swim over, boy. That's neutral island there. Be gob, they might detain you. That'd be great. We'll saunter about, say hello to the country folk, and have a lovely meal or two, and then we'll find a way down to Dublin. Oh, man, dear, there's the town for fun. It never sleeps. Bursting with people from all over Europe and the ends of the earth. A Constantinople of the West." My hands were gripping the rail. This moment was the moment of best chance. And then I stopped. The ghost was laughing gently. "You must be daft." I stepped back from the rail and looked down at the deck in embarrassment. I agreed. "Yes, nuts, completely nuts." "The time to go to Ireland," said the ghost, "is when I tell you to go, not before. Trust in me, and the back of your hand to the devil." In the summer of 1950, the ghost told me it was time to go to Ireland. "Take your brother over," he advised. "If he wants to be a doctor, that's the place for him." My younger brother Hugh did want to go to medical school and lacked the two requisites for admission in America, high marks in pre-medical courses and a member of the family in the medical profession. In Dublin, Hugh would at least find the latter, Dr. Matthew H. O'Connor, Professor of Pathology and Dean of the Royal College of Surgeons, Ireland. We did not advise this gentleman of our coming. We just boarded a ship and hoped we would be cordially received. Now, there happened to be at that moment a war in Korea, and it left me with some unsettling thoughts about American life. Before Korea, my feeling about my country had differed little from John Wayne's. I, too, in my own way, thought we were a hero nation, that America simply could not, by its constitutional nature, go far wrong. If someone had asked, "Do you believe that no matter who is at the helm of America, God is the captain?" I might have flinched at the religiosity of the question, but I would not have debated it. After Korea, I was more than willing to debate it. When Hugh and I were sailing to Ireland, the war was 3 weeks old, having begun the last week in June. We were members of a Montana National Guard unit and expected it to be called up. We simply had to look at the trip as a summer holiday that might be cut short. It was a presidential war. The fiction promulgated by Truman that the war was not really a war but a United Nations police action against bandits, in which we were merely a part of a lawful international posse, was derisory. And it was insulting to American troops who were soon looking round the battlefields and seeing mostly themselves. When Hugh and I arrived in Dublin in the summer of 1950, we telephoned Dr. Matt O'Connor, who was my father's first cousin. He greeted us familiarly, as if he had always known us. Matt, as he asked us to call him, had an unusual history for an Irishman. He was born in New York and was brought as a very small immigrant to Ireland. There he stayed for the rest of his life. He was instantly charming. He was a medical scientist and an engagingly witty talker, conversant in politics and the arts, a theater and concert-goer, a notable host, a reliable friend, an Irish gentleman of the first rank. His warm hospitality did not extend, however, to placing a relative in the College of Surgeons. He said that no one had ever been admitted by mere passage through the office of the registrar. The annual entrance examination in science, mathematics, and English, a pretty formidable barrier, was to be held 6 or 7 weeks hence. The candidates' list was complete, but Hugh's name would be added. Nepotism it was, but not crass nepotism. Hugh would have to pass the exam. He would have to start studying for it immediately. Hugh enrolled in a grind, which we here know as a crash course. My plan was to return to New York, report on the trip to my mother, then return to Montana to finish my junior and senior years at the state university. But for some reason, I decided that Hugh needed me in Dublin. He did not. He was a mature 22, well-traveled and confident of himself. He had served a hitch in the United States Regular Army, and while a sergeant on occupation duty in Japan, had been offered an opportunity to prepare for West Point. He declined, wishing to go into medicine. I passed my time walking about, looking into shops and pubs, the Trinity Library, the art galleries, writing letters. I went to the theater. Dr. Matt O'Connor was able to arrange a little social time for Hugh and me. He drove us here and there, sightseeing, and to meet his sister Aileen. This was a most important visit. Everybody in the family in Dublin referred to Aileen's residence in Pembroke Road as the flat, and nearly everybody turned up there on Sunday afternoons for 5 minutes or 5 hours. People never felt they were imposing on Aileen, because she all but forbade them to leave. She hated going to bed, where, she reminded us, most people die. She said she needed no more than 2 hours of sleep. The flat, with its stream of weekend visitors, was a microcosm of highly opinionated Dublin. Doctors, lawyers, poets, writers of articles and plays, students, business people, and ordinary working people. Aileen was happy to see Hugh and me. She professed to be out of touch with America, but she was eager not so much to hear the news, of which she was really well apprised, as to hear our particular version of it, and to observe how we looked and sounded telling it. She was unmarried, about 56, small, with a pretty face and smile and very keen eyes. She liked to stand in front of her sitting-room fire, facing her seated guests, hands clasped behind her back, a cigarette held in her lips, its long ash bending toward the floor where it usually landed. It was with Aileen O'Connor, at the flat, that the notion of my remaining in Ireland was broached. "Isn't it a pity," said Aileen, "that you won't be staying on with Hugh? Couldn't you finish your B.A. at Trinity or the National?" "I doubt it," I replied. I was then engaged to Nancy, who was about to enter her senior year at University of Montana, and expected to see me back there in September. But I did not dismiss the idea. I began to think that if a transfer of course credits were manageable, I might profitably and pleasantly spend the next couple of years in Dublin. After all, this was not a small university town, but one of the oldest capital cities of the world, once a center of Western learning, and though completely foreign to an American, it made its unique culture entirely accessible through a common language. I wrote to Nancy, "The time would pass quickly, and you could come over next June as soon as you graduated, and we could be married here." Her reply was at once sad and glad, and she said that I ought to stay. I was admitted to University College Dublin. I was to pursue a B.A. in European and Irish History with a subsidiary, a minor, in English Literature. Hugh was pleased, and so were Matt and Aileen and the rest of the family. I wrote the news to my mother in New York, and she responded happily Hugh and I would still be together. Hugh passed his entrance exam for the College of Surgeons, and he and I took a flat in Lower Leeson Street, which we invited another student to share, an American, Arthur Fidel, who became a lasting friend. I liked Dublin and liked the university, but by the third week of Michaelmas term, about the end of October, I was in depression. I could not shake off a feeling of foolishness. A man of 26, plodding through the days and months on funds from my mother, with no plan, and the trusting girl I loved was coming over in the summer to marry me. How did I intend to manage that? The ghost said, "Don't worry about your young lady who's coming over. She'll manage everything for you." One day, Art Fidel told me that a couple of the students in the Dramatic Society wanted me to be in a play, but were shy about asking me. I seemed to them a little stern and distant. I was delighted. I made them happy by agreeing to play the father in Thornton Wilder's A Short, Happy Journey to Trenton and Camden. The evening they planned also offered a scene from Marlowe's Faustus. And when an actor had to withdraw from this, they persuaded me to take his place. I was the plumpest Mephistopheles ever seen on the stage. I was acclaimed the hit of the evening and could hardly wait to be in another production. I was not a raw beginner. I had played at University of Montana in Life with Father, Winterset, Our Town, and Antigone. I had taken a couple of drama courses and even joined the Maskers, the student drama club. I met Nancy while acting in those UM plays. She was acting too, and also designing stage scenery and costumes. Art and drama were her major undergraduate studies. The next production of the Dramatic Society was Chekhov's The Cherry Orchard. It was important to the students, for it was going to tour to Galway and be part of a national student drama festival, and there would be a prize. We did not get the prize, but the adjudicator gave a spoken critique of each play, and she highly praised our Cherry Orchard. She gave a special praise to the characterization of Lopakhin, that is, to me, and I was profoundly pleased. She was a professional director, and she said there was something professional about me. And I thought then and there that I should be happy to have the chance of acting professionally. The chance came in the spring. The Dramatic Society put on a very interesting and celebrated modern verse play, and I was discovered in it by a professional producer. The play was T.S. Eliot's The Cocktail Party, and it was publicized and reviewed by the Dublin press as if it were as important as anything the professionals were doing. Our press notices were very good, and everybody in town attended, including Miss Sheila Richards, actress, producer, director, and soon to be a friend of great importance. She sent a note offering me a part in a play that she was going to present at the Gaiety, Dublin's most beautiful theatre. I accepted at once. My part in That Lady, by novelist Kate O'Brien, was small but good. Set in the court of Philip II of Spain, it was nicely written as a piece of imagined history, but it offered no thought that followed one out of the theatre. I became aware of a theatrical truth, something I never had to consider as an amateur playing in established old hits. People want to leave the theatre with some insight into the human condition, something that, in the light of their own experience, they can find value in. Since that time, my own test of value has been the amount and kind of conversation the play evokes over supper. and not only supper the night of the play. Sheila told me at tea one afternoon, "I hope you'll stay with acting, and I'm wondering if you'll go with me and Lennox Robinson this summer to Edinburgh, the annual drama festival. We'll do Sing's Playboy, and Yeats's Kathleen O'Houlihan, and Lennox's White-Headed Boy. And we'll have Siobhan McKenna and her husband Dennis O'Dea from the Abbey, and Dennis Brennan and Liam Gannon from the Gate, and me, of course, and a few others on holiday from the Abbey, and you." "Me," I said, "in a representative Irish company?" "Well," she replied, "you've got the right sort of name, and I think the talent." Nancy was with me on that tour to Edinburgh. It was our honeymoon. Nancy had got her Bachelor of Arts degree in Art and Drama in June, and arrived on a ship at Cove in July. I met her, we came up to Dublin by train, and she took a room in a little hotel in Hatch Street. On the following day, we went to see the pastor of St. Kevin's Church in Sing Street and applied to be married. We were indignantly refused by the priest, who ordered me to send Nancy back home for 6 months until a dispensation could be got from Rome. Nancy was not a Catholic. We went instead to a Church of Ireland, which was spiritually close enough to Nancy, who was raised in the American Episcopal Church, and it was close enough for me, who at the time was not attending the Catholic Church or any other church. In due course we were married, that is, in the middle of rehearsals, the 28th of July, 1951. Nancy and I asked for the Saturday off to do it, promising to be back at rehearsal promptly Monday morning, and the day was given to us gladly, though not without astonishment and hilarity. It was not the way people got married in Ireland. My brother Hugh was back in New York for the summer, so Art Fidel and a girl he knew stood with us at the ceremony in St. Anne's in Dawson Street. My bride was tall, 6 feet, slender, shapely, and beautiful. She was 20. We four and the celebrant made up the occasion. There was no one else in the ancient little church. Sheila Richards directed the Sig and Yeats plays, and Mr. Robinson directed his own play, and our company was the hit of the festival. We were asked to do The White-Headed Boy for the BBC, and in late September the company reported to the Alexandra Palace in London for our first, for most of us, live television appearance. I was as happy as I had ever been. I could not see the outline of the future, but the distant glow seemed healthy enough. All depression was, I was certain, forever gone, and the ghost proved to be right again. As soon as we got back from London, Nancy applied for and got a job at the Abbey as assistant scenic artist, and I got a phone call from Josie Macavan. She had recommended me for a part in a new play at the Gate. Something had to suffer neglect. It was the studies, and when I got my B.A. in 1952, it was not honors, but a pass. "They tell me you're an American," said Hilton Edwards, co-founder of the Dublin Gate Theatre Company and a superb actor-director. We were in his office, in his house in Harker Terrace. "That's right," I owned, "but I think I can play an Irish part for you. I've been doing Irish characters all summer in Edinburgh and London." I gave him the details, and he handed me a copy of God's Gentry, a verse comedy written by a Dublin poet, Dunagh McDonagh. "Would you mind reading this for me? The part is the first policeman, and he's from Kerry. Do you know Kerry?" "I do," I answered. A lie. Yet not altogether a lie. I had not yet visited Kerry, but the speech of my Kerry grandfather was vivid in my memory, and my ghost and my divil, who had always been with me, were patently Kerrymen, both of them. We read a page or two, and Hilton put down his script. He went into another room and brought back his partner, Michael McLeamore. He asked me to repeat the reading. He was exuberant. He had not believed that a foreigner could exactly represent the Kerry brogue. Michael McLeamore merely smiled at me and said, "You'll do very nicely, my dear, and we'll see you at the theatre." He shook my hand and went away. Getting into the Gate Company was thought by everyone a great stroke of professional luck, and with good reason. What Edwards and McLeamore had brought to the Irish theatre since they conceived their Gate Company in 1927 was a world presence. The boys, as Hilton and Michael were affectionately known, had never been content to stay idle between seasons. Excepting the war years, they had spent their holidays on the continent looking at theater in Germany and France. They had always stopped in London to catch the latest British hits and the imports from Broadway. And what they observed with keenly comprehending eyes and found innovative and important, they applied to their work at home. An appreciative Dublin looked forward to each new gate season with delight. Hilton gave me my first voice lesson. He said, "You're bringing it out of the throat, over the tongue, and straight through the mouth. Wrong! It must go up and out through the mask. The whole face, the whole head must resonate like a violin. Suppose a violin were merely a wooden box with one round hole in it. Weak, my dear boy, very weak. When you speak, think face, face, face." Michael once said something to me that turned out to be my most valuable acting lesson ever. My part in the play, Ring Round the Moon, was very funny, but the audience wasn't laughing. I felt terrible. I felt out of place, miscast, a drag on the show, and I was grumbling about the situation. I said to Michael, "You know, Hilton really ought to replace me in this one." "That might put you at your ease," Michael replied, "but not us. Your replacement might make the same mistake."
"What mistake? Tell me."
"The mistake of knowing as the character that you're funny. As the actor, you know it, of course. But in comedy, my dear, the funniest character is the most serious man on the stage." I used to say those words to myself years later, before every performance of Archie. Worried, confused, flustered, inflamed, serious, serious Archie. I owe Archie to Michael. Archie made the people laugh. Before Nancy and I left Ireland, we went on a tour with a new theatrical company formed in 1953 by the renowned Irish actor Cyril Cusack. In Waterford, a film producing company from London offered me a movie part, which, of course, I did not feel free to take, and it struck me that I had best go where the big-time activity was, London or New York or Hollywood. I did not imagine that Ireland offered a character like me much in the way of upward movement, and I was right. When at last we sailed away to America, and the tender was bringing us out to the liner, Nancy could not bear to look back at the shore, and when she did risk a last glance, collapsed in tears, as though her heart was breaking. And what did I do? I looked stiffly toward the ship, with the devil in my ear whispering, "Shut her off, for the love of God. The idiots on this barge will think you're murdering her." I was entirely mistaken in imagining that my professional readiness, acquired through my prestigious Gate Theatre experience, was going to be the key to success in the States. Nobody in New York in 1954 cared the least about me or anything I had done in Ireland and England. Within a month, I was sorry we had come home. We were staying at my mother's house in Forest Hills, and we had to make some money and find a place of our own. Nancy took the lead. Within a week of setting foot ashore in New York, she had gone down to the Board of Education in Brooklyn and inquired about a teaching job. They arranged for her to take the art teacher's exam. She passed it. They granted her a substitute teacher's license and assigned her to a junior high school on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. We decided that I was to devote myself to making the theatrical rounds. But then I saw, after a few embarrassingly barren weeks, that we were going to need some income from me as well. I, too, went down to Brooklyn, and finding that an exam in history in my field was not being offered, took an exam for a substitute teacher of English. I was assigned to a junior high school in 47th Street on the west side of Manhattan. During this first short teaching job, I got my first job on American television. My very closest Irish friend, the actor Liam Gannon, who had been a regular member of the Dublin Gate Theatre for several years before my arrival, came over to New York to try for better luck. He looked up a young American named George Roy Hill, who had worked and studied at the Gate in the late 40s and was now becoming known in New York as a television director. Hill gave Liam a part in the TV play, and Liam recommended me for another part. I began looking for a New York agent and referring once a week to a casting bulletin board at the Actors' Equity office in the old Hotel Edison. When my teaching day was over at 3 o'clock in the afternoon,
I often met Liam Gannon for a cup of coffee and then, like scores of jobless actors, made the rounds of casting offices. We signed in on long legal pads on the desks of receptionists all over Midtown Manhattan. Presumably directors and producers hopped out of hidden offices from time to time, scanned the yellow lists, and found a forgotten name that might be plugged into a small role. But I was never summoned back to see a director. I saw only receptionists who all said, "Hi," without a smile, and pointed to the pads. In the summer of 1954, Nancy went to Missoula to visit her parents, and I found work in a first-rate summer theater tour of New England, playing a gentleman's gentleman, a small part in the play Witness for the Prosecution. We both went back to teaching in September, this time in high schools, I on the Lower West Side, the Chelsea District, and Nancy in the Ridgewood section of Brooklyn. When school holidays came around again, we bought a new Oldsmobile and drove to Missoula for a short visit that turned into a long stay. Nancy's parents, Ralph and Hulda Fields, welcomed us home. It was the summer of 1955. I said something to someone at a party about the great pleasure it was to be back in Montana, and out of that came an offer from Professor Bert Hansen of the Department of Speech at the university. I could have a master's degree at no expense if I taught speech to freshmen and sophomores for a year as a graduate assistant. I thought about the offer and told Nancy I wanted to accept it. She was agreeable, but not enthusiastic. Being away from New York for a long time fretted her a little. She was sure I was on the verge of a break on Broadway. I felt idiotically that I had been rejected by New York. To run right back to New York could mean simply to waste more time there. Nancy knew the truth, that I did not take rejection well, meaning that I was not one for stubbornly pressing forward to an objective. My tendency of old habit was to substitute an easier objective. Missoula, nestled in a beautiful foothill environment, was proud of its richly forested university campus and its charming old western town. Nancy was invited by the Missoula County School Authority to devise and set up an arts program for the elementary schools, and she accepted the job for 1 year, thus continuing to be the major earner under our roof. We were soon enjoying Missoula and campus life. Here were not only Nancy's parents, but 100 loving old friends who were constantly feeding us, entertaining us, and joyfully anticipating our staying in town forever. I began mulling that over. The heads of the performing arts faculty seemed to want me to stay after I earned my degree, and when June came, I too wanted to stay. But things were not what they seemed to be. The department heads did not want me to stay. Nobody invited me. I was sorely bothered, but Nancy took it all with equanimity, not to say serenity. On the return drive to New York, she revealed exactly how she felt. She was completely delighted to be on our way back, and said to me over and over, "Wait and see, good things are going to happen now." Derisively, I said, "Now? Right now?" She retreated a little. "Soon," she said. For the time being, we had to return to teaching. Nancy was assigned to teach art at Franklin K. Lane High School in Brooklyn, and I was assigned to the High School of Performing Arts in Manhattan. But at the end of the fall term, both Nancy and I had an offer from a producer who wanted to start a winter stock company in St. Louis, Missouri. We worked in a good new theater in the round. Our company was not without talent. Our work was more than acceptable and showed signs of becoming quite good. But the worst winter snowstorms the town had seen in decades kept the customers away for weeks. The theater shut down and the company went back to New York. Nancy read in the paper that Burgess Meredith was about to produce a stage version of James Joyce's prodigious novel Ulysses, the most influential piece of literature of the century. I was facing the old problem, no agent to submit me for an audition, but I grabbed a phone and called Meredith at the Rooftop Theater in Lower Manhattan. I did not get him on the phone, but got his assistant, the actor-director John Astin, and said, "You can't do this play without me, and you have to give me an audition without delay." After a little spate of defensive questions and aggressive answers, Astin fixed a time for me to come and audition for Meredith, that very afternoon at 4:00. When I got there at 4:20, Meredith, Astin, and a couple of other people were leaving the theater. I walked up to Meredith, whom I had never met, and said, If I'd been right on time, you would have been long gone. Meredith said, what? And I replied, you forgot all about me, didn't you? Meredith turned to Aston. What's he saying? John Aston explained. He had indeed forgotten, hadn't written it down. He apologized to me and asked whether I could possibly return tomorrow, but Meredith intervened and said, no, I want to hear him now. To me, he said, do you know this novel, Ulysses? He held up a copy in front of my face. I said, yes, and if you're going to include the character Buck Mulligan in the play, I'm the best actor anywhere to play it. Meredith instantly said, let's go back up. By up, he meant up in an elevator, because the rooftop theater, a small 500-seater, was actually on the roof of the building, and the building was the grand old National Theater. Meredith had no play script for me to read, but he handed me the novel and said, open to the first page and let me hear you read some of it. I got up on stage, turned to the first page, and the famous first lines. Stately plump Buck Mulligan came from the stairhead, bearing a bowl of lather on which a mirror and a razor lay crossed. A yellow dressing gown, ungirdled, was sustained gently behind him by the mild morning air. He held the bowl aloft and intoned, Intro ibo ad altare dei. I read on for two pages until Meredith stopped me. He called from the back of the theater. Okay, you play Buck for me. What's your name? This sounds like a scene from an improbable movie, but it is an exact report. Nancy came into the production as designer of costumes, technical assistant to Burgess Meredith, and understudy for three women's roles, Bella Bello, Mrs. Tallboys, and Molly Bloom. The memorable character, Leopold Bloom, the Dublin Jew, was played by an extraordinary actor, Zero Mostel. The play script, Ulysses in Nighttown, was a major New York hit. Nancy and I enjoyed a close friendship with Burgess Meredith from 1957, when Ulysses made his debut, until his death last year in September. As an actor, he was unsurpassed, and yet he was undervalued. He was recognized most appreciatively, yet not much talked about. His work was completely satisfying. We frequently traveled abroad together and worked together as acting colleagues and featured in television movies. Our son Hugh grew up in his company, and when Hugh ended his life, Burgess was shattered by grief. For a time he would not speak of Hugh's death, as though denying it. To me he was a friend of high importance, deeply fond of me, as I was of him. Of all friends, the most admiring, encouraging observer of my work, and he gave me a priceless gift, a way of inducing a charge of self-confidence before any entrance. Always remember this, mon fils. They're waiting for you. My appearance in the first New York production of Ulysses brought me some attention. Lionel Lana signed me to his agency, Baum Newborn, which later became GAC, General Artists Corporation, and still later International Creative Management, which still represents me through its vice president, Jack Gilardi. Lionel Lana has become my personal manager. During the next 10 years, or until I started playing Archie on television, I made 20 movies and probably 50 television, film, and video dramas. Agents promoted this unusual run of activity. The very first movie I acted in was made on the East Coast before Nancy and I went west. I played a local volunteer fire chief with 4 or 5 lines, but my next picture for Warner's gave me a good supporting role, a newspaper publisher, and the cast included Herbert Marshall, Ephraim Zimbalist, Donna Meachie, and Angie Dickinson. This movie, A Fever in the Blood, was directed by Vincent Sherman. It was a story about crime and state politics, but the writing lacked specific force. None of the characters could dominate the action, and audiences did not know whom to watch. I made little or no impression in the thing, but my agents hustled me into one television job after another, and also into another movie, Kirk Douglas's Lonely of the Brave. Clearly, Hollywood was the place. The work was plentiful, the money and billing were continually upped by my agents, and also, a perquisite most valuable to any indulged person, the treatment I experienced contrasted joyfully with that of New York. There, I always knew that if I keeled over dead while signing one of those yellow pads, I would be thought of with relief, merely as one less tiresome person. When Nancy and I and our son Hugh were in Rome in 1969, a friend persuaded me to meet a kind of an interesting guy, another American who had been living in Italy since the end of the Second World War, a man, I was told, with a good idea for a movie, Ralph Liguori. I brought Ralph to a table in the garden of the hotel. Actually, I led him slowly. He wore spectacles with very heavy lenses, and he held my arm tightly as we moved along. He was all but blind. Ralph ordered Campari. So did I. I raised my glass, wished him health, and said, "Ralph, tell me your story." He hesitated, then said, "You look like somebody." "Well, I've been in a bunch of movies." "No, no," he smiled. "I don't see no movies." He waved a hand in front of his eyes. "The Peepers is gone." His speech had all the character of poor New York neighborhoods. "Ralph," I said, "is your story something out of your own life?" Ralph nodded. "Yeah, at 45, I got deported with Charlie Lucky. I'm talking about Luciano. They stuck us on a ship over to here. I was put in Rome and Charlie was put down south, and the Italian cops, they said we was to never meet." "We met. How are they going to keep us apart? Two guys like him and me, close so many years." "Is Luciano in your movie idea?" I asked. Nah, we leave Charlie out. It's about me." Ralph began to talk his way toward the promised story. It was about himself and Thomas E. Dewey, a former governor of New York, twice a presidential candidate, who had been a special rackets prosecutor in New York when Luciano had been in lawless primacy there. "Dewey framed me and Charlie Lucky. He got this madam and 3-4 of the putan who worked for her to say they brung money to me and Charlie in a saloon downtown, $100. His smile opened derisively. "Here was Charlie doing $4 mil a year with the numbers, like $25 mil today, with a floor of offices up in the Channon building, and me with him, and they grab us for a thing like that. The papers called Charlie the Vice King, me, Ralph the Pimp. They could get away with that in the papers, but anybody said that to me out of his face, he ain't got no face no more. It was the only way Dewey could get us. So Dewey scares the poor broads to death. He gives them money, and they beat it to Europe when the trial is over. One jumped out a hotel in London." Thomas Dewey, he told me, visited Europe after his electoral defeat by Harry Truman, and came, of course, to Rome. His tour of the town brought him to the Pantheon, and Ralph was among the small crowd in the piazza observing him curiously. Ralph touched Dewey's arm, and Dewey turned with a smile, but the smile gave way to a look of shock and terror. Ralph, in his soft voice, said, "Hi, Tom. You're looking good." Dewey, a small man himself, was staring at a slightly smaller one, a pudgier one in shirt sleeves, peering only half-seeing through thick eyeglasses, straining to smile to ingratiate himself, hardly the fearsome bullet of a man the prosecutor had sent to Sing Sing. "Listen, Tom, could you say a word for me back home? I want to go home, that's all. Just a word to the right people back home would help, Tom." Dewey nodded rapidly. "Sure, Ralph, why not?" "First chance you get, huh?" Ralph chuckled. "And that was 10 years ago. Scared to death he was. Well, what do you think?"
"It's an interesting scene," I said, "but it's only a little piece of your movie."
"Well, naturally we gotta fill it out, but that ain't no little piece. That's the big scene."
"Your movie," I told him, "if we could find a way to make it, probably begins with your mother bringing you to New York on a ship. And it ends with you leaving on a ship. And it's about everything in between. It would have to be very real, truthful, because we've seen a lot of pictures about the mob, mafia pictures. People want something different, something new."
"I can tell a lot of things to you, but I can't put them in my movie."
We finished our meal without much talk. I offered to find him a writer, but he told me not to bother. He didn't want anybody but me to write his movie, and anyway, the movie could only portray himself and Tom Dewey, and just actors.
"Just actors," he said. "Nobody real."
Back in the States, I made the second revised pilot episode of All in the Family. And when, like the first one, it was rejected by the ABC network, I decided to return to Rome. I got a writing deal from one of the DuPonts who wanted to go into the movie business.
Nobody liked the script, my friend the late Burt Lancaster said of it, "I don't know what's going on, kiddo." I got in touch with Ralph, and we met again at the cafe near the station. He asked me to come with him to his apartment for lunch. The apartment was a pleasant one in a well-maintained pre-war building a short taxi ride away, and when we walked in we found his wife dressed to go out and not at all prepared to give us lunch. She was embarrassed and made me promise to come again for dinner.
"Okay," said Ralph, "we'll go for sandwiches, but first we'll have a little something to give the appetite."
He poured two Campari with shots of gin. We sat a while in silence, and then he said,
"So what's on your mind?"
The question surprised me. I said, "Nothing, Ralph. Anything, whatever we're talking about." He nodded.
"Just asking."
"Why?"
"Oh," he said, "just the way you come up to me today. You give me a little hug, first time."
He was shrewdly right. I had something on my mind. I'd been wondering since I first met him whether he could give me some rather special information about Sing Sing Prison in New York. "Not for a movie," I said, "or anything like that, just for myself, just between the two of us." He shrugged.
"There ain't a hell of a lot to tell. The worst of it was being locked away could drive you bughouse. It helped if you had friends and some dough."
Some seconds passed in silence. Ralph watched me, waited for me to hear what was on my mind, knowing already what it was. "You said once or twice," I began, "that I looked like somebody."
"Yeah, you do. Ed O'Connor."
"When you were up there, did you know him?" He nodded.
"I knew him. I knew him well. How is he?"
"Gone now. He's gone nearly 3 years."
"Yeah. Fine man. Hell of a lawyer. Charlie Lucky used to often talk to him about his case. So did we all. He helped a lot of cons with cases. He taught school up there, too. How come it took you so long to mention him?"
I didn't know what to reply. Should I have mentioned him earlier? I rarely mentioned my father to anyone. Asked about him, I always replied, "He was a lawyer, gone now," and said no more. Then why was I talking about him now?
"Were you ashamed of something?" Ralph asked.
And that, of course, was the reason I hadn't talked about him. I was ashamed of myself, Ralph.
"What did you do?"
"It's what I didn't do. I never worked out a way to talk about him honestly, except now and then to my mother."
Ralph replied, "Listen, your old man was the best. He was a gent, and he was smart. He knew everything worth knowing, and he got big respect. He was like a boss. Even the screws was a little scared of him. You know what we used to do?"
Ralph chuckled with amusement.
"We used to make spaghetti in the yard. Would you believe it? We had a stove in the yard. The screws used to bring it out for us and light the fire. We even had wine. Your old man would come eat with us now and then, and we'd all talk over the news from New York and laugh it up and have a swell time."
He fished for a few sprightly big house yarns, obviously to lift my mood. He asked me how often I had visited my father in Sing Sing. I told him about my 3 trips. I recalled how, on the train moving up the Hudson Shore to Ossining, my mother and I used to decide what and what not to tell my father. How we planned our responses to his expected questions, preparing to assure him that nothing had changed at home and school in the neighborhood. All a lie. Everything had changed. But Mama made believe everything was the same. And my father made believe that he believed everything we told him. Ralph nodded.
"Like a boss. Nobody would ever know what he was thinking. Nobody."
Looking back, and I had looked back often, I was sure I had discerned in my father the symptoms of a very bad old problem, a disease that had also afflicted his only sister. He was schizophrenic. For the same pathology of delusion, though a much more aggravated form of it, his only sister was confined for half of her life to a mental institution, and there died. Schizophrenia, when its result is not grand larceny, is treated in hospitals, not prisons. Ralph LaGuardia and I did not go out for lunch. We had another of his powerful cocktails, and then drank beer and ate panini and salami and cold pasta and salsicce, and stared out the kitchen window at the rear roofs and terraces of Rome. We watched the women hanging out wash. I didn't see Ralph again. I got deeply dug into my screenplay, and suddenly I got a hurry-up call to fly back to Hollywood and appear in 13 trial episodes of that untitled series. We retained our Roman apartment, garaged our car, packed a few clothes for a short stay, and flew to Los Angeles. Nancy and Hugh and I didn't get back to Rome for 3 years. And when I got back, I didn't call Ralph. I had a feeling he was dead, but I didn't want to be told he was dead. My ghost said, "Ah, that's daft. You're as likely to be told that he's alive." The devil said, "Not at all. He was half dead when we were with him last. I saw the dark angel in his eye. Gone he was, and glad to be gone." Of course, he was also, as Ralph had said, a brain. He had an uncommon breadth of knowledge and understanding, and it went far beyond his own field, into history and literature, and also into mathematics, physics, and mechanics. Yet this charismatic mind could shift undetected to a mode of casuistry wherein fraud and larceny were blameless devices of good motives. To use an expression I hear at every turn these days, he felt good about himself, that is, free of guilt and regret. He wondered what he had done wrong, how it happened that his defrauding other frauds of huge amounts of money caused so much horror in society. And he concluded that he was perpetually the victim of skewed analysis.
I said to a friend, "I've never been good at predicting the popularity of anything. My predictions are unreliable, whether I predict success or failure." The friend replied, "In plain words, you can't smell a hit." My friend said it well. Norman Lear smelled a hit in the British comedy that became All in the Family. Not that he possesses a super sense, he's produced some flops, but he never doubted, as many did, that this venture was going to be a big hit. To me, when I first read about it in an article in the Saturday Review, it was evidently an outrageous piece of comic satire that only the fearless BBC would try to get away with, and did get away with, airing it as Till Death Us Do Part once a month for a year or so. It centered on a right-wing working-class fool who in his home freely vented his crudely racist, inhumane convictions. Not 2 weeks after reading about the British show, I got a call from my agent, Jack Gilardi, who said that someone wanted to talk to me about doing the same show here, an American version. I could hardly believe it. The ABC network was interested in doing this mad thing and had agreed to work with a smart young fellow who had secured the American rights to it. ABC had told him to sign me to play the lead. I said, "Jack, I'll talk to him. The thing is a sure disaster, but the explosion will get us a lot of attention." A pleasant young man with an Eastern College look to him, Howard Edelman, came out to Malibu Beach, where Nancy and I and Hugh, 6, were spending that summer of 1968, and I made a deal with him, script unseen. We began talking about where the principal character came from, and he agreed on New York, though someone had suggested Texas to Howard. We talked about casting, and Howard began seeing pairs of kids for the parts of the daughter and son-in-law, and driving them out to Malibu to let me look at them. He mentioned some actresses' names to consider for the part of the wife, but didn't suggest that I meet anybody. The part of the wife in the British original was very different from what it became in Jean Stapleton's unforgettable characterization. The British actress played perfectly what was written for her, a suffering soul, yet a crusty woman who was ready to do combat with her boorish Cockney mate at the drop of an H. I had the American actress well in mind if we were going to play the wife as she had been played on the BBC, but we could not get the gifted Marge Redmond, my choice, released from another series. Eventually the part of the wife got a completely new character, one that nobody else had in mind but Jean Stapleton. Jean's idea of Edith Bunker was not only original and perfectly suited to the American audience, but very comical and emotionally very moving. Jean invented the character that made the series work. The benign, compassionate presence she developed
made my egregious churl bearable. Howard Adelman told me one day that ABC wanted him to associate himself with Bud Yorkin and Norman Lear, a team experienced in producing TV comedy specials. A messenger shortly afterward brought me a script, and I was given an appointment to meet Norman Lear. I read the script and didn't like it from the first page to the last. The writer wrote jokes for four actors, but had no grasp of the characters of any of them. I decided to do a complete rewrite, but having only a day or two to do it and no secretarial help, I wrote everything over in longhand and then tape-recorded the whole script, reading all the parts. When I went to meet Lear, I played this tape for him, and he gave it to his secretary to transcribe as a new script. The cast worked with this script as it came to them, with only a few technical changes, and it was videotaped as our first pilot before an astonished audience in New York. Lear did not inform the cast of what I had done, and I, assuming he had good reason to say nothing, said nothing myself. I didn't require a writing credit and fee for the extra contribution. It was enough for me to make sure the play was right. I knew the press would sanctimoniously attack us when they saw and heard a television character open fire on the blacks and Jews and Hispanics, but I didn't want them to be able to say that the character whom they were now meeting as Archie was a distortion of his counterpart in the real world. The ABC network made our first pilot episode in October in New York. We rehearsed in the old Ansonia Hotel and taped the show in a theater in West 58th Street. Then Nancy and I and our son Hugh rushed for a plane to Europe. Returning from the vacation, we flew directly to Los Angeles, and on arriving home I learned that ABC wanted us to retape the pilot episode. Its raw honesty seemed exceedingly daring to the audience that saw it taped. Some found it almost intolerable. But all were wonderfully entertained in spite of themselves and laughed longer and louder than any audience I had ever played to. I was surprised by the demand for a remake. Lear explained that ABC wanted to recast the characters of Mike and Gloria. But the kids we used, Tim McIntyre and Kelly Jean Peters, had seemed very effective to me. We made the second pilot with the same script and two new kids before an audience at the ABC studios in Los Angeles. ABC looked at the pilot again. The guiding minds said nothing about the second pair of kids, who were not as good as the first, but decided at last to say how they really responded to the product. They shrank from it. If we wanted to try another kind of Gleason show, another kind of Lucy show, fine. But they were petrified by the thought of anything as boldly unconventional as this. I wish the public could have seen our work, but doing it and hearing the big laughter of the audiences made the experience joyful and memorable to me. And then there was Jean. She and I had met before while performing in an episode of the old The Defenders series in New York, in which I played a murderer and she delightedly played a witness who fingered me in court. But it was on the pilot that we became friends, and on the series, fond and lasting friends. Archie made everybody laugh. So did Edith, and so did Mike and Gloria. But Edith helped work a change in America, and she did this by signaling and encouraging a change in women. What we then called the women's movement, or sometimes, snidely, women's liberation, was getting into stride, and Jean, besides being herself involved in it, and being a pace-setter in the real world, saw to it that Edith, observed by 25 million people every week, was a courageous women's champion in her own imaginary family. Before Edith came and endeared herself to America, women who lived with fellows like Archie were usually submissive and suffering in the face of roaring non-think. After Edith, they confronted non-think a little more sternly and stiffly, and gave hint of a serious readiness to rebel, just as Edith rebelled from time to time. Did our series effectively attack bigotry and racism? We thought so at the time. Our intention from first to last was to get on the flanks of the legions of Cluxbury and wound them to the death. But Cluxbury, while it howled laughing at us, ignored our serious, dabbing instruction. I got busy again doing some television jobs and a movie up in Utah with Bill Holden called The Devil's Brigade. Following this, my friend Gabe Katzka, who had produced and cast me in a Jim Garner Marlowe movie, asked me to come to Yugoslavia to make his new movie, Kelly's Heroes. Nancy and I and Hugh left for Europe again, this time aboard the Italian liner Michelangelo, sailing from New York to Genoa. There we rented a car and drove east to Trieste, and from there at the highest allowable speed, east by south through Slovenia, Croatia, and Serbia, to the city of Novi Sad on the Danube. Nancy and I made new lasting friends on the picture, Don Rickles, who is playing a principal role, and his wife Barbara. And another star of the picture whom I knew from other happy mutual endeavors was the late Telly Savalas. The original ending of Kelly's Heroes, though tragic, gave the thing some meaning, but it was changed in filming to something comically incongruous that left the work with no meaning whatever. Nobody cared. The picture was a success. It still plays regularly on television. In the middle of shooting, I was allowed to leave for what they said was a month or so, subject to a sudden recall. We went down to Rome, and later I had to fly back to Serbia for 3 days to film a scene. Gabe Kaska told me that on returning to Rome, I ought to start driving back to our final location, the Istrian town of Umag on the Adriatic, and there we would wrap the picture. Nancy's mother, Hulda Fields, had flown over from Montana to be with us and help us with Hugh, and she had never been abroad, so we made a little tour out of our return to the movie. I took a rectangular route north to Como and Basel, the Swiss city on the Rhine, and east through Germany. The stay in Munich was memorable for a delightful Oktoberfest, a reunion with an old friend of student days, the American tenor Robert Hoyam, who was brilliantly singing my old favorite Hoffmann at the Stadtspielhaus, and finally a melancholy pilgrimage to Dachau. Nancy and I and Hugh had been in Munich the year before, and I had avoided Dachau. But now Nancy decided that Dachau must not be avoided. This time we would see the place, and her mother too agreed that we ought to see it. Driving through the pleasant village, it was hard to conceive that anyone living there in the war years, excepting, of course, small children who were probably discouraged from asking questions, didn't know what was going on in the neighboring concentration camp. The Third Reich, given its absolute control of news and the whole communications apparatus, could have disguised the exterminating activities of the camps. Some Germans could have been kept in ignorance, but many must have learned the truth. What they should have, could have done about it is still a subject of angry debate among people of my generation. It must have been out of anguish that the state of Bavaria had memorialized the inhuman incumbency of the Third Reich in this camp of Dachau. It was a museum, and it comprised a newspaper exhibit in which the history of Nazism from 1932 to 1945, in enlarged press photos, covered a circular wall. Also the preserved prison itself, dozens of concrete slabs marking the barracks, surrounded by walls, barbed wire, and gun towers. And finally the place where murdered Jews were burnt to ashes. I told Hugh I wasn't feeling well and wanted to sit down and rest. Nancy urged me to go along, but I hung back and waited. The truth was, I was afraid to confront what I had seen in news film and stunning magazine stills. Afraid the black moors of the ovens would blame me and curse me. I had always felt like a passive accomplice in all this. I had heard, "Hitler is doing many good things in Europe," over and over in the city of New York, spoken by people in all walks of life during the 30s, as late as the defeat of France. And I had been a non-reacting, contemptible listener. Just a kid? Yes. But a smart kid who lived familiarly with Jews, who read everything and knew, at least from the newspapers, what was going on. Until I saw this museum, I hadn't thought about the non-Jewish political pariahs of the Reich. They were all classified as Reds. The world was invited by the Nazis to approve their destruction, and the world seemed happy to do so. Now I was learning in this press rotunda that of the thousands who died in that first concentration camp between 1933 and 1945, half were non-Jews who had bravely fought fascism and Nazism. When Kelly's Heroes was finished, we flew home to Los Angeles. I acted in a couple of movies, Doctor's Wives, starring my friend Richard Crenna, Death of a Gunfighter with Richard Widmark and that remarkable star Lena Horne, and some television series episodes. And then Max Arno of my agency made a deal for me to write a movie. He liked my script outline, and so did another client of his, the head of a new production company, John DuPont, the man who later shot The Athletic Trainer in Maryland. The story was centered in Rome, and I wanted to go back to Rome to write it. We took an apartment near the Piazza del Popolo. Hugh, 8, went into an English-speaking school. He took a bus to it from the piazza every morning, and I met him in the same place every afternoon, ice cream time. We would sit al fresco at Rosati's, and he would practice his Italian, giving the order. He picked up the language easily. In the early morning, I would watch him from our terrace, walk to the piazza, say buongiorno to the concessionario, who had charge of the parking, and kept a special eye on our car, for which I rewarded him well, and went on chatting with him until the bus came. The chat had to be mainly Italian because Salvatore spoke very few words of anything else. For Hugh, this was a third visit to Italy. His first was the 1968 trip following the taping of the Archie pilot. Hugh, then 6, knew all about his adoption, having asked Nancy some direct questions about being conceived and being born. We took him at that time on a visit to Salvator Mundi Hospital in Rome to show him where he had been delivered to the world. He met Mother Johanna, the supervising nun who had attended his birth, and Father Coyne, the priest who had baptized him, and he was shown the nursery where, according to the Mother Superior, "You were sleeping right there in one of those little beds, and you had a friend beside you, a little Sicilian prince who was born at the same time." Hugh seemed most interested in all this, seemed to be enjoying it, but, of course, we had no way of verifying his inner feelings. He was keen enough to know that we wanted him to react happily. He loved us and may have wanted to please us. Nancy, who, unlike her timorous husband, has never been afraid of drawing pleasant conclusions from the plainly visible, assured me that our darling boy was in a glad mood throughout the visit. Next day, one of those special Roman days when the sky is a limpid curtain in front of heaven, the three of us were walking in the Borghese Gardens near the Casino Valadier, and we came across a group of 20 children 5 to 10 years old. They, too, were on a walk conducted by 3 Sisters of Charity. They went by, and 6-year-old Hugh said, "Why do their parents dress them all the same way?" I said I was sure it was the nuns who dressed them that way. He thought about this as he watched them walk out of sight. Then he said, "Dad, do they live with the nuns?" Nancy answered, "Yes, Hugh, they live with the nuns. They have no parents." I watched his handsome little face, wise and still, and took his hand, knowing beyond any doubt that he had imagined something that might have been himself among the same dressed kids. Now, just over a year later, he seemed well-adjusted to our new Roman life, which was full of movies and browsings in bookstores, activities at school, outings with new friends. I was sure I was writing a very good movie script, but the first draft was a disappointment to my partners. I felt stupid for putting so much work and hope into the script. I began to get phone calls from Beverly Hills about the Till Death series that ABC had twice shied from. Jack Gilardi of GAC, the agency representing both Norman Lear's company and me, got me on the phone and said that CBS had picked up the discarded item. The roles of the kids would again be recast. We would do the same material we had done twice before, but this time it would not be a pilot, but the first episode of 13 on air. I had lost interest in it. I thought about it and decided not to do it. I still felt that it would not go far. Nancy disagreed. She reminded me that I had always wanted the show to be seen, even if a bad reaction chased it off the air. I replied that I would probably do it if we happened to be in Los Angeles, but we were now living in Rome. We had a car, professional connections, good friends, and a life that seemed wonderfully removed from the black cloud of Nixon's Cold War. Though, of course, there was really no escaping that anywhere in the world, and in fact Nixon's enormous helicopter roared immediately over our terrace one evening as it conveyed our mysterious leader to the roof of the Quirinale, the Italian government buildings in the Via 20 Settembre. I had begun thinking of us three as being permanent residents. Hugh liked Rome and seemed delighted to say, "I was born here." Nancy's advice was fly back and do a couple of installments of this series. Do the 13 the network has asked for, and then we'll fly back here. The history of my series, which we started videotaping as All in the Family during and after the holidays that preceded 1971, is too well known to brook a review here. An interviewer once said to me, "That show opened up a big window on America," and then immediately changed his statement to, "No, not a window, it pulled down a whole side of the house." This writer said that while Archie had a likable vein, his character was exposing the whole American idiosyncrasy of faults. The enduring misconceptions, the cherished prejudices, the stubborn ignorance, and heedless cruelty. Leah didn't write for the show, but he gave the writers orders, watched dress rehearsals, and gave notes. He hated to tamper with a joke, and he and I had frequent arguments about jokes. Some people, but not many, thought we were presenting in Archie a false character. President Nixon thought we were making a fool out of a good man. George Meany thought, and told me personally, that we were showing a distorted picture of the American working man. The late Whitney Young, longtime head of the Urban League, said we were acquiescing in racism. Young thought we were treating it like a joke. Spokesmen for the black community generally doubted whether All in the Family was helping the black community, yet being unsure, they declined to condemn it. Leah was irritated by my calling the series a satire. But if it was not, then Richard Nixon was right, and we were doing the persona of Archie Bunker injustice. When I asked Leah how he would define the series, he answered crisply, "Why does it have to be defined?" I remained, however, the one insistent guardian of satire. With the end of the ninth season of All in the Family, the cast members' contracts expired, and all except me announced, with no regret, that they had different things they wished to do. Jean wanted to rejoin her husband, producer Bill Putch, in a couple of stage ventures. Sally Struthers was interested in getting a series of her own. Rob Reiner wanted to write movies. I was going to miss them all, and especially Rob. He and I were very fond of each other. His major interest at that time was writing, and acting was his next. I had no idea that he was going to move suddenly into the directing game and turn out a half-dozen hit movies in a row and become one of the most important movie makers in town. I had no plans. As for Leah, I had been told by someone or other that his contract with CBS had expired, and he had decided to take Family off the network and release the just-finished 9 seasons to syndication. I was asked, nevertheless, by CBS President Robert Daly to keep the series going, somehow, in network prime time. He said he wanted to make a new deal with Leah. I told him I didn't see how Archie could carry on without his family, but he wanted me to make it happen. He said the character was too strong and popular to be dropped. Leah didn't agree, and he was obdurate. Daly could not persuade him. It appeared that money was not the issue. William Paley, the Ayatollah of CBS, happened to be in Hollywood and asked Daly to arrange a meeting with me. Paley had not asked to meet me in the 9 years that my show had kept his network at the top of the ratings, nor had he communicated with me in any way. He had met and entertained the stars of all his big CBS shows, but though he never had a bigger show than mine, he shied from contact with me. I don't blame him. Someone had told him, evidently in a convincing way, that I was in life, not merely in my series role, the man he saw on the television screen. He had no important reason for inviting a fellow like that into his home. Now, Paley might have risked the distress of a visit by me and Nancy in order to confirm or dismiss what he had been told, but then why should he bother? Who was I, really? I was not important. But now I was important. He wanted to meet me at least in an office. I met him in Daly's office at CBS Hollywood, and he asked me what it was Leah wanted. I said Leah wanted to take his flagship show off the air. "That we know," said Paley, "but what else?" I said I had no idea, but if Leah, in spite of the alarmed opposition of his gillies at Tandem Productions, was rejecting another year or more of profit from the show, he probably had peculiar personal reasons. Paley said, "Leah's in New York, and I'll see him tomorrow. I'll bring him in, if you agree to do the show." I told him I would agree to try, but I warned him that without the regular cast, I might not be able to devise and produce a continuing program. He went to New York and failed to bring the quarry in. And Bob Daly called me and said, "Carol, you're the one that'll have to ask Norman." I went to Norman Lear's house and asked him. He told me he preferred to see the old show die an honorable death, saying, in other words, it would die without honor if it stumbled on under my direction. But Lear at that time laid honor aside. He overcame his sadness and let us proceed with the dear old show under the name Archie Bunker's Place. He insisted, however, that we retain the Edith character, even though Jean Stapleton would not be here to play it. Edith, he thought, would be retained in spirit. Later I was told that I could forge ahead without Edith, but I would also have to do without the old title and without the old song. We opened the new season the 10th, if like me you still thought of the show as All in the Family, with a one-hour episode called The Death of Edith. I wrote it and co-directed it and was delighted eventually to win the Peabody Award for it. Archie was staying on at his well-known house on Hauser Street, and with him were his two nieces. He engaged a housekeeper to help him with the little one. Something of human significance had to happen to Archie, or the show would become Archie Bunker's joke store, and the best way to make it happen was to expand his circle of friends and acquaintances. I hired the gifted actor, the late Martin Balsam, to come out from New York and play Murray, Archie's new Jewish partner. I hired Ann Mirren to come out and play Archie's new chef at Archie's Place. The aim now of our scripts, of our series of small plays, was to show a man who was finding out not only that he could live without his prejudices, but that without his prejudices he could live better. Viewers now laughed in a different way, always copiously, less often explosively, but they kept laughing. I was enjoying the work more than ever. As we were opening our 12th season, CBS told me that Archie Bunker was finished after the 1983, the fourth season. We pressed the network to keep us on the air for 1984, a fifth season, as this would give us a block of five to sell to the syndication marketeers. Five was the package likely to bring the highest price. I was also thinking about Hugh. He had come to work for us as a general office assistant. "I'm a gopher, Pop," he laughed. And I was scheming to work him into something better in the years to come. Lear told me that at the urging of his partners, he had personally appealed to Paley to keep us going. He said, "I watched an episode with him," and Paley said, "Sorry, it isn't funny anymore." "And you said?" I inquired. Lear, with an odd moue of distaste and satisfaction, replied, "I said I had to agree with him." Following the cancellation of Archie Bunker's Place, a play called Brothers was the vehicle I chose to carry me back to the New York stage. I found the play in 1983, running in a small theater in Costa Mesa, south of Los Angeles. The characters were a father and four sons. Their sad story was that the younger son required a kidney transplant, and one of his brothers, after agreeing to be the donor, changed his mind. I decided to direct it and play the father as well. I firmly believed that I was going to bring in a hit, but, as I confessed earlier, I have no nose for a hit. The Times Review killed any advance sale. I closed the show that night. I lost a bit of money, but I look back fondly on the experience because it let me bring my son into the business. Hugh, then 20, was with me throughout the production, rehearsals, and run of Brothers. I gave him the job of assistant stage manager and told the production stage manager to show him how to do it. He learned stage management well in those 8 to 10 weeks. The one thrill I recall from that show was hearing his deep voice outside my dressing room door, "Half hour, Pop." Then going out to the stage and finding him in the prompt corner, his production script on the rostrum under the hooded light, earphones on his head, mic around his neck, preparing to order the lights down and the curtain up. He was, as all the boys and girls on Broadway say, a real old pro. He had earned his equity card, and he was on his way. Following the Brothers disaster, Orion Pictures and I produced a TV movie in New York called Brass, a police picture for which I wrote the script and played the leading character, the chief of New York Police Department detectives. For the role of the chief's driver, I cast two cops who divided the duty, one a beautiful Spanish girl named Bigona Plaza, who played her character as a New York Puerto Ricania, and the other Hugh. Hugh said to me, "I'll play the part, Pop, but do you really want me to be an actor?" I said, "Son, your pop hasn't got a business to leave you. My business is not a tangible asset. It's all experience and know-how, and I want to give you every chance at every phase of it." He played his small part well, as I knew he would. Brass was well watched and liked. The reviewer on the Times hated it, by the way, and singled out young Hugh for a mean slash. The reviewer, John O'Connor, was a cousin of mine. In the meanwhile, we went back to Los Angeles and devoted some attention to another money-eating failure, the Ginger Man restaurant in Beverly Hills. My friend and partner Patrick O'Neill, who had previously opened a popular restaurant of the same name in Manhattan, came out to Hollywood to play in my remake of the movie The Last Hurrah for Columbia and Hallmark, and in the course of the shooting he mentioned to me his intention of opening in Beverly Hills. He asked me if I wanted to be a limited partner. I was delighted and told him I wanted to be his general partner, 50-50, and we did the thing together. We opened about 10 months later in July of 1978. That summer, by the way, was both grim and happy. In the June just passed, Nancy discovered a tumor in Hugh's neck. I emphasize that Nancy discovered the thing because she had noticed the classic Hodgkin's lump in his neck, and when a doctor diagnosed it as a swollen gland, she didn't believe him. She led an angry, unwilling 16-year-old to two other internists and found out that she was right. Hugh went into the John Wayne Cancer Center at UCLA to be treated for Hodgkin's disease. He endured three surgical invasions, the first into his foot to introduce a detection dye to the lymph system, the second into his neck to remove the tumor, the third, the most disturbing, into his midriff to remove the spleen, the lymphatic haunt of the disease. The happy news of the summer was that after effective surgery and radiology, he seemed to be headed for a normal life. In 1984, our restaurant was in its sixth year on Bedford Drive off Wilshire Boulevard. The place had been a great success, making a profit till about 1983, but now it was just carrying itself. Losses loomed. I had by then bought out Patrick and renamed the restaurant Carol O'Connor's Place. The restaurant needed a night manager, and Hugh, at my request, put himself under a day manager who trained him for a couple of weeks to take over. He was now 23. His job was meeting, greeting, and seating people, adding up all the covers at closing, reconciling the cash with the paper, stowing money in the safe, and locking up the doors. He was fast and accurate with figures, smoothly ingratiating to customers, very good-looking, handsome in his business suits. He did it very, very well. But dark things were happening. The dope crowd were in and out, and neither Hugh nor any other employee offered to identify them to me. Nor would my own people admit that even a little dealing and using went on from time to time. Even so, it was being bruited about that one of the places where one could score was my place. I always had and still had excellent chefs and service, but my good customers were vanishing. I held meetings with the staff. I asked them to help me rid the place of the dope menace and to bring down costs in about 10 specific ways. The bar seemed busy, but the bar was losing money. Food was unaccountably missing. But we didn't work hard. We didn't do any fresh thinking. We never reversed our losses. We never identified the dopers that were preying on us. We never recovered the popularity of our first 5 years. In general, my Mexican employees, including a highly talented chef, wanted to make a go of it. My Americanos, most of them, didn't care. And theirs was the slack attitude that prevailed. Hugh really didn't know how to help me. Being a drug addict, a fact that I couldn't see, he ignored the many ways in which the losses of supplies, the increase of non-paying sodden malingerers at the bar, the newly exceptionable look of the crowd, were hurting our business. Hugh was always serene. He never saw bad people anywhere. What he thought was wrong with the restaurant was its old-fashionedness. What I ought to do is turn it into a jazz club and let him and a couple of his friends run it. He and the slow-witted, dope-smoking pals he had in mind were as fit to run the jazz club as to run a health club. But, not to put him down, I seriously discussed with him the restructuring and renovation that would have to precede this change. We agreed that $500,000 would be a low estimate and $1 million would not be too high. And we had a good-natured, ongoing exchange of hot air over the matter until it was time to go south to begin a new series. One important lunch meeting at the restaurant was with Fred Silverman, the well-known producer and former head of entertainment at CBS, ABC, and NBC. He and I talked over the new series in the heat of the night. I wrote and directed a test scene in which I played Gillespie opposite five very good black actors who were testing for the role of Tibbs. Howard Rollins was my favorite, but a couple of the production executives preferred one of the other four candidates, O.J. Simpson. Simpson looked superb and played the scene very well. The president of NBC Entertainment, the late Brandon Tartikoff, allowed me to make the final choice, and I chose Rollins. I saw in Rollins' acting a unique, clairvoyant insight into humanity and character. He had a fine voice, he had an exceptionally good-humored, amiable disposition. Acting was above all things his preoccupation. He had little interest in celebrity, and his sole ambition was to be recognized as an actor preeminent in our theater. If dear Howard had lived and had got control of his life, which drugs had so wounded and knotted, he would have been a towering figure in the theater. The Heat of the Night company went to Hammond, Louisiana, in the late fall of 1987, prepared to make 6 episodes of the series, plus a double episode, 2 hours, a kind of pilot. Hammond is a town 45 minutes by car north of New Orleans and the bayous, and its friendly people made us most welcome. But one had to search the town with diligence and without much success to find its southern aspects. Interstate and state highways had spawned a utilitarian culture that had pushed the ancient disposition of affairs out of existence. Shooting the series as we did, we wrote and shot unintelligently, we need not have gone south at all. The stories could have been filmed in Dubuque, Iowa, or at the MGM studio lot in the neighboring streets of Culver City, California. The South, in the mind of our female producer, was a kind of Transylvania with a sneering drawl. The South was the American locus of morbid souls and macabre events, of primitive brooding blacks, wealthy white lunatics, horribly spoiled racist bad boys, and devilishly grisly murders. Her scripts and the ones she ordered from her writers were preposterous. Nevertheless, these scripts, when blown out into film through the intrinsic magic of the medium and the razzle-dazzle artifice of designers, costumes, composers, and editors, got the show by. But getting by was not what I was content to do. My contract with MGM NBC gave me the right, as story editor, of collaborating on all writing for the show. Despite this, my producers week after week rejected my work on the scripts, and I detested the work and was going to step away from it. The producer took this with remarkable aplomb. She did not care what I did, confident that MGM and the network would be content to replace me and retain her. NBC told MGM to replace her. MGM then hired, with my ignorant approval, a certain husband and wife writing duet to produce the next season, 1988-1989. This pair immediately did the show a service. They moved its location to the typical southern town of Covington, Georgia. But alas, their first service was their last. They chose to ignore the dramatic resources within the real environment and wrote what we may call situation nondescript, as if they were using a cliché plot matrix, spongy enough to knead and mold to suit all locales, all characters. We reported to Georgia, and I angrily barged into the new season, resolved, however, to bolt at the finish of it. One Friday in late February, shooting beside a stream on a wickedly cold day, I felt tired, and blamed myself for getting too little sleep the night before. I went to my motorhome between takes, sat down with a cup of coffee, stared out of the window through a wavy film of ice on the glass, and decided to call it a day. Ed Ledding, my line producer, quickly rearranged the shooting schedule and sent me home to bed, asking if I wouldn't drop in to see the company doctor. The company doctor referred me to Dr. Thomas Cruz, a first-rank cardiologist of Covington, who examined me and sent me on to Emory University Hospital in Atlanta, where I became a patient of Dr. Willis Hurst. Dr. Hurst, formerly President Lyndon Johnson's doctor, ordered an angiogram, and afterward he and his chief associate, Dr. Spencer King, told Nancy and me that all three of my coronary arteries were closed, each one in two places, and would have to be opened not by angioplasty, but conventional surgery. I asked him whether it couldn't be done immediately. I didn't want to languish in the hospital till Monday contemplating the knife. Dr. Hurst called Dr. Joe Craver, a peerless heart surgeon, who agreed to come in and scrub up the very next morning, Saturday. Joe, a big, merry old boy and former All-American from North Carolina, made 6 bypasses in 7 hours, 2 in each of the 3 arteries. On the 8th day of my recovery, Dr. Hurst came in and said, "Carol, the gallbladder is frequently a problem after heart surgery, and we're going to have to go in and get yours." And next day I was wheeled downstairs, and another surgeon, Dr. John Henderson, went in and got it. The 3-week ordeal was not as shocking to me as it was to Nancy and Hugh. She had prepared herself for loss by prayer and willpower, while he had looked for escape from panic in the transportive power of cocaine. When he came to see me, he was unable to make easy conversation. He was toxic, very hard to talk to. It was his first occasion to binge during a working season of the series. There would be other occasions. I missed the final 3 episodes of that season, and when we went back to the West Coast, I was certain that the series was over for me. Nancy made me walk firmly, guiding and pushing me west along the Malibu beach and back east by the road every day. I found myself meeting neighbors seen rarely or not at all in 11 years of occasional living on Broad Beach, and also some old acquaintances who sojourned there as seldom as we, the Jack Lemons, Walter Matthaus, Dick and Dolly Martin, Dustin Hoffman, Abby Lane and Perry Leff, Steve and Edie Lawrence, Bob and Millie Wise. Such is the nature of showbiz, all of us most of the time on the move, missing one another, headed in all directions. Being thickly ignorant of medical science, I began only then, weeks after the surgery, to understand what had happened. The arterial blockages in the heart had been forcing the old pump to find other routes, to push blood through by way of whatever tiny interstices there were in the muscular tissue. My heart had been laboring at this for a very long time and was ready to give up when Spencer King saw the awful condition in his angiogram. Cholesterol did not appear to be a cause. My count, according to the doctor, was that of a homeless man, 38. The cause was tobacco, which I had smoked addictively in all its forms for 50 years. And in my hospital room the Friday night before the surgery, believing Nancy to be in the nearby office answering phone calls, I was actually inhaling a Sheraton pipeful of delightful Dunhill. Nancy swooped in, grabbed the pipe, made a fast, triumphant search for cigarettes, and threatened me with assault if ever again she saw me as much as light a match. She got rid of all smoking paraphernalia except a gift from Hugh, a beautiful lighter that projected a jet of flame into a pipe bowl, which I reprieved by explaining that it was good for lighting candles. I can't believe that any addiction is more tenacious than smoking, and but for the consecutive surgeries and the pain and distractions they caused, I would have remembered my need and satisfied it before I left the hospital. One effect of convalescence was a deep depression that I thought would never end. My heart doctor in Los Angeles, Ann Hickey, asked me to describe what I was feeling, and I told her something I had not told Nancy, that certain surreal fantasies, both waking and sleeping, strongly implied that I didn't have a right to be here, that I was meant to be gone, and that there was something sad and wrong about my walking around on Earth. The fantasies were short scenes in which I was moving about among people I knew who didn't speak to me but looked at me as if I was someone else, a stranger. The doctor assured me that this would pass, that it was a common consequence of heart surgery, and put me on an antidepressant medication. Anne was right. My spirits were soon back to normal, and I couldn't remember when I had felt so well physically. The blood was flowing again, and my oxygen supply was now plentiful. Sometime in May, I got a call from Dave Gerber, president of MGM-TV, to inquire whether I had thought about doing another season. I told Dave that I despaired of finding producers who could write and run the show to my requirements, and that if I returned, I would have to take over full management. I modified the proposal by inviting Fred Silverman to share with me the title of executive producer, and this proved acceptable to all. I became the hands-on executive producer working at the production site. Fred became the symbolic exec, remote from the site in the South, comfortingly close to the nervous network. Plots were no longer about incredible persons from other places passing through Sparta. Imported drama, I used to call it when I was demanding that former producers stop relying on it. Our new episodes were about local people, the crimes and investigations, the chases and arrests and trials rising from local people in local situations. This alone guaranteed originality. I was able to make the stories delineate the contemporary changing South, a South that, in my opinion, was far ahead of the North in coming to terms with the racial justice so recently won by the civil rights movement. Sparta became a town where there were socially prominent and civically important blacks as well as whites, poor and working-class whites as well as blacks. Politeness and cordiality normally prevailed in the interracial encounters. Interracial romance was shown without comment. Our series was twice given the NAACP Image Award for favorably depicting blacks on film. I have many people to thank for my success in the South. We all have many people to thank. But I must acknowledge a large debt to the doctors at Emory University in Atlanta for extending my life. In December of 1994, Hugh's wife, Angela, was deeply worried. She didn't tell us the worst of her fears. When we called her and asked, "How are things?" she answered, "Not much change, I just keep hoping." Note that an addict's loved ones use circumspect language. The question, "How are things?" means, "Is he clean today?" The answer, "Not much change," means, "I haven't seen him snort coke or gulp vodka, but I think he did." Why do we talk in code? Code, we hope, will protect us from the awful truth of plain language. We are wrong, of course. We feel the pain of truth in spite of any evasion, and we find that the evasion itself inflicts a pain. Angela was doing more than just hoping. She and Hugh were visiting a psychologist, a therapist, whose specialty was addiction. She, to get help in dealing with it, he, to get himself off it. And they were consulting the therapist together and singly several times a week. She was working hard to maintain something like a normal marital environment. But Hugh was taking drugs, cocaine and vodka, and various prescribed uppers and downers he was getting from his doctor. Angela told us that she wanted to bring their baby Sean to Atlanta, to her mother's house, for Christmas. I assumed that Hugh would go with her, and I was content with that arrangement. He would be separated from his pushers, both in New York and Los Angeles, which hardly would be an obstacle to his scoring, but would be at least a benign inconvenience for him. I was remembering our Christmas of 1993 in New York, and praying that we could avoid another of the same sort. My thoughts are in my diary of that period. New York, Friday, December 17th, 1993. My brother Bob, who is a psychiatrist, consulted with Hugh at his apartment in the Dakota. I don't know what Angela is going to do about the holidays, whether or not she'll stay here in New York. Not that staying here with him is the best thing for her to do. Maybe all of us ought to accept his illness as something we have to live with, not fight. I don't know. I'm merely casting about for something new to say. Everything I say is old. Is there anything new? Saturday, December 18th, 1993. Hugh got into a big argument with Angela. These continual fights they have are exclusively about drug use. They have everything. Love, youth, a career, a home, a precious baby. Hugh walked out and flew to L.A., leaving wife, babe, parents, family to spend Christmas without him. No bye to me. And his last word to his mother was that she's a big mouth. This because she asked Bob to talk to him. Tuesday, December 21st, 1993. Hugh came back to New York today. 3 days in L.A. Why? What did he do there? He coked without interference. What else? There is nothing else a cocaine addict wants to do. Wednesday, December 22nd, 1993. I was up and out with the dog before 9 a.m. Hugh, who had been fighting with Angela and stayed with us last night, stayed in bed till afternoon, then got up and went to the Dakota, and he was allowed in and went back to bed. We had calls from my mother's brother Jim and my mother's housekeeper Teresa, summoning Nancy and me to the Esplanade. Teresa reported that Mama hadn't been able to keep food down and had been in bed all day. My Uncle Jim said to me, "Your mother's real bad," and I said, "No, I think she's good. She looks good, but she's 93, and it's the end. That's all." Friday, December 24th. Too cold to go to see the tree at Rockefeller Plaza. Besides, on all these sightseeing occasions, I become one of the sights. Nancy always makes Christmas fun, but for me, it hasn't been fun since kid days. My father made it fun, and that's why now it's sorrowfully nostalgic. A memory of times, love, laughter long gone, never to return. What are my own son's thoughts about his Christmases past? Amusing incident. A very fat woman driving a car cut in front of me as I was crossing Central Park West this morning. She yelled out the window, wanted to know if I was who she thought I was. I yelled back, "Madam, I'm trying to cross this street with this dog." By the time I had entered the building and got to the elevator, she had jumped out of her car, leaving a frightened male passenger in it, and followed me on the run to the building with a camera. A doorman was in hot pursuit. "Just one picture," she wailed. My dog Emma tried to take the camera away from her. She yelped. Emma barked. I whined simple-mindedly, "People like to be left alone," and pushed the elevator door closed. Saturday, December 25th, Christmas Day. Hugh came in at about 10 a.m. Hugh delighted me by being fine and sober at dinner, utterly normal and, of course, charming. Happiest Christmas family dinner in ages, even though Mama could not be with us. Sunday, December 26th. Hugh and Angela, though they plainly love each other and are crazy about their baby, don't appear to be having any fun together. When poor Hugh is not Blotto, he's ill recovering from Blotto, or suffering trying to fight it off, leaving Ange in a permanent state of funk, unable even to think of living a normal life. I hate to think it, but she may by now have had it with him. I think she's nearly ready to take the baby and bolt. Wednesday, December 29th. Snow at noon. Angela and Sean stayed at our place for the night. Angela's reason for staying here was that it was yet another bad old cocaine day for Hugh. It's taken me a long time to accept the central fact of this addiction thing. A cocaine and heroin user wants to do nothing, really, but use. Angela tells me that passing the night with a cokehead at close quarters is like being with a big mechanical toy that can't be switched off. Friday, December 31st, New Year's Eve. Small party here tonight as usual. Not a happy day in the forenoon. Hugh in his dope pit at the Dakota, Angela deep in sadness here, wondering how long her marriage can stand this strain, and my mother over in the Esplanade dying. But there must be something the matter with me because I'm rather composed in confronting it all instead of being in a slough of melancholy. Am I callous coming into old age? I'm surprised that I have no tears. I wonder if Prozac should be credited or blamed. After 2 years of taking it, I feel no ill effects, nothing physical, though I do feel in a way closed in, as though defended from strong emotions, sometimes unenthusiastic. Hugh and Angela did not come to the party, spent the night together trying to believe each other's vows. Saturday, January the 1st, 1994, New Year's Day. Mama died at about 6 a.m. Mama died as she lived, no trouble to anybody. Nancy said she gave us all a great life. True, she did. In April, she would have been 94. I'm going to miss her more than I can imagine at the moment. I used to enjoy going to her for long family talks with plenty of laughs, many more laughs than sighs. But all that ended a couple of years ago when she began to drift away from conversations. Tuesday, January 4th. Final viewing of Mama. Only family were there. Mass was the regular 11:30 daily Mass at Blessed Sacrament, and many neighborhood people were present. I like that. Father Robert O'Connor, no relation of ours, was alone on the altar. He read the traditional short service and commented well on life and death. It was windy and cold under a somber sky, but Calvary Cemetery under snow looked beautifully antique and was curiously comforting. We took everybody at graveside for a 2 o'clock lunch at the water's edge in Long Island City. Wednesday, January 5th. I stayed in all day except for a couple of outings with Emma. On the first of these, I met my pal Walter from Oklahoma, a homeless man who frequented the park. He offered me a gulp of his Cuervo Gold tequila. I refused. Walter likes me. I have twice given him 20s, and he has given me a pair of heavy woolen socks. Today I went back to the apartment and got him a sleeping bag I had promised him, one that Nancy bought a few years ago for one of the kids. I brought it down and gave it to him at the entrance to the park. I made him hide his tequila in one of his plastic bags he was carrying. Don't let people see that tequila. Many of them are all too glad to be able to call you a drunken bum. Walter, about a third of the way into his trip to Blotto, shrugged and smiled and said, "A drunken bum is what I am." Mama would have had a great laugh over that one. I'm afraid Walter will have the sleeping bag taken from him. I'm afraid he may sell it or trade it for booze, but I can't worry. When he asked me what he could do for me, I told him to ask the Lord to do me a special favor, to help someone I love very much. If you ask Walter, I bet the Lord will do it. Walter thought about it. If the Lord helps him, will you tell me? I said I surely will. My brother Bob came by the apartment to show me Mama's will, which he had gotten from the lawyer. Seeing her signature on the will made me cry. I hadn't cried up to then. She had signed her name in the small, beautiful hand I remembered so well. How often she had written Elise P. O'Connor for me, for the thousands of things I needed, or thought I needed, over a lifetime. And now in the year 1994, it was December again, and Nancy told me that we had an invitation to spend Christmas with other friends in another town. We needed it. There is hardly a town so different from the rest of the world as Rome. Yet Rome is still the world, a most comforting corner of it. We accepted the invitation. I got a piece of very loving and entirely useless advice. Leave your troubles behind you and have fun over there. But the pith of trouble is thought, and thought will not be left. Rome, Thursday, December 22nd, 1994. Fog, mist falling, then a few dashes of thin, sweet rain. Nancy and I went out Christmas shopping, and our boy was constantly above all in our thoughts. I had written a new series for CBS entitled Savannah. I wanted to use some of my Heat of the Night cast in it, for instance, Hugh, and I desperately wanted him to get himself straight. I needed some help myself, but there is little help available to one who loves the addict. Help before a final tragedy occurs. Help in learning how to let go of the anxiety of the days in waiting for the worst. Some people are helped by groups like Al-Anon. Nancy and Angela had already attended Al-Anon sessions. They had thereby infuriated Hugh, which is typical. Friday, December 23rd. I went with Gigo, the photographer, to the Spanish Steps to make photos for the Italian TV guide. Heat of the Night is well-liked in Italy. Also well-liked, Archie, or Archibaldo here. Nancy phoned L.A., learned that Hugh went to Atlanta today. Angela and Sean have preceded him by a couple of days. Why? Why would he want to stay in L.A. by himself? On the phone, I said to Angela, he wouldn't be misbehaving, would he? You mean some girl? Yes, is it possible? She replied with a small, unamused laugh, no. No interest in sex, just cocaine. Sunday, December 25th. We enjoyed Christmas Day dinner at Ettore Bernabei's big apartment in the Via Flaminia. And on December 28th, we flew from Rome to London to spend New Year's with friends. And then on Sunday, January 8th, 1995, we flew from London to New York. I used a wheelchair. Legs are hurting. It's not the aircraft, but the terminals that try my nerves. Nancy talked to Hugh in L.A. She said he didn't sound good. Monday, January 9th, 1995. My mother's brother, my Uncle Jim, died early this morning. Jim has been living in misery and asked his doctor about a shot. The doctor regretfully refused. Talked to Lionel Lana, my agent. He had finally reached Larry Sinitsky, one of the top CBS executives, who admitted apologetically that he had not yet read Savannah and assured Lionel that I am very important to CBS. I phoned Hugh about Jim's death. He regretted it, seemed sober but distracted, voice toneless, controlled. I thought it's like a fantastic piece of sci-fi fiction in which a strange being inhabits the person of someone you love. Wednesday, January the 11th, 1995, a small, cold funeral for Jim. He would not have minded. It wasn't much better than a burial on a battlefield. He would have preferred that. Bob ordered the plainest possible box, no wake, no announcements. We said the prayer, just the seven of us, and left before the coffin was lowered. No tears, nothing at all. I can't figure myself out. I loved him and should have paid more attention to him and didn't, and I should have cried for him and didn't. We all just went home. Jim, I think, got the last place left in the O'Connor plot. As for me, wherever I shall last be seen on this earth, find a nearby spot. Thursday, January 16th, 1995. Angela called twice to tell me where she was with friends, and again to tell me that Hugh had checked into Brotman, the drug rehabilitation place. On Saturday, January 21st, we flew from New York to Los Angeles. Wednesday, January 25th. Hugh called me from Brotman. Very pleasant chat. I don't know why I'm so relieved that he's there. Very few addicts are permanently turned around in these places. The usual thing after a patient's sign-out is a few days of sobriety and then a relapse. But he's there, not using, as I write, big comfort, a false comfort. Every bit as false as a drug high. Sunday, January 29th.
caught a few minutes of DeMille's Samson and Delilah on the old movies channel. What a fantastic display of illiteracy, tastelessness, and shrewd commercial instinct. To Arno Way to visit the Hugh O'Connors. Stayed for a dinner of burgers, dogs, and corn on the cob. Had not seen Hugh since September 4th at Malibu. He looked good, was quite sober, was angry with his situation, but not really angry enough with himself. He should be. Too bad he isn't. But he hated going back to Brotman after his 8-hour leave. Brentwood, Tuesday, February 14th. Sean was here, left by his mom, all day to about 9 p.m. Angela had a lot to do. Hugh got leave to meet her for lunch, and he met here. He looked solid and strong, but his dress was poor. Sean smiled broadly when he saw him. Hugh still assertive, confident, but I doubt whether his actual self-esteem has improved. His clothing compares with the people he has always sought out. Inadequate, below par, third rate. Saturday, March 4th. We took Angela and Hugh to dinner at the restaurant Georgia. We dined in a bitter atmosphere. No loud words, but many harsh words between our kids, and nobody had a good time. Some very sad, silly stuff. For instance, Nancy and I didn't order drinks. We really didn't want them. But Hugh got furious, said we were abstaining because of him, treating him like a child. He insisted that we order drinks for ourselves. We did as he wished. When the drinks came, he said, "Screw this," and ordered a drink for himself. Nobody said a word. Too bad. It was supposed to be celebratory. Angela's birthday. It was miserable. Saturday, March 11th. Hugh stays home at Adorno, smoking coke and drinking. Angela stays here at Tilden with us. My cousin Gary, a doctor, was here from 11:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. coaching us on how to make a complete break with Hugh. That being the only way, he says, to force him to a cure, or rather to cure himself. This is the tough love tactic. We all nod, and we know we don't want to shut the door on him absolutely. I finally had to say that I could not refuse to talk to him or see him. I can't cut my kid off. I can't. I'm not strong enough. We're all depressed here. Saturday, March 18th. Hugh came here for a family talk, a loving, conciliatory talk. He hoped. He left angry. He didn't get what he wanted, that is, Angela's agreement to return home. She told him that she must see him not only sober, but in a promising frame of mind. He left here, went to Barrington, where his pusher lived, as I predicted he would, bought cocaine and returned here. He would not then leave, and from about 7 p.m. till the following morning, roamed the house, our house, with staring eyes, gripped by hallucinations of men nearby outside and men entering the house to see Angela. The last time I saw my son, before he killed himself, he was going one way and I was going another. He into his house, I driving away to mine, and I was relieved to be getting away from him for a while. It's hard now to believe that that was my thought. I have to remind myself that I had spent the night with him, an unforgettable night of watching him hunt through the house, room after room, and then hunt again, driven by cocaine hallucinations of enemies in the place, one of whom was trying to steal his wife, Angela. She had come with the baby to spend the night with Nancy and me, and they were in a two-room guest suite. Hugh had twice knocked on their door and had been told by Angela to wait till morning, to go away and let her sleep, to let the baby sleep. He had twice come back to me in the living room and reported with alarm that Angela wasn't there. He reminded me of someone else, of another cocaine frenzy, of other staring eyes, swollen and inflamed, beloved and precious Howard Rollins, telling me that voices, including mine, had attacked him from his fireplace, insulted him about his sexuality and his talent,
Howard later escaped the grip of cocaine. Hugh could not. In the final deadly phase of cocaine intoxication, when suicide is likely, when suicide becomes an inviting alternative to mental agony, the victim cannot save himself by an effort of will. He has lost the power. People deride this. They argue, surely he has a sober moment when he understands what he's doing and what's happening to him. True. And when I left Hugh at his door, he himself was having such a moment. But sober is not drug-free. Sober is toxic still. Free momentarily from delusions, but far from being rational, being able to discuss the ominous meaning of his condition. In this lucid yet impaired state, pleas to return to treatment are to the addict worse than useless. They are adversely provocative. He is actually in a dying mode. The mode can only be reversed by prolonged detention in a rehabilitation hospital. And this cannot lawfully be imposed upon a person who is not threatening anyone. The maximum lawful detention of an addict is 3 days. Allowed to go, the addict relieves the agony of being down. He immediately orders cocaine from his pusher. Riding this cycle, he finally overdoses and dies of heart failure, or he insanely kills himself in a panic of paranoia. Hugh, on this cold morning, out of cocaine and oppressed by sorrow and self-hate, asked me to take him home. He wanted first to see Angela, and she came out of her room. She had spent many nights with Hugh like the night I had just spent. Hugh now tried to persuade her to come home with him, but she calmly, firmly refused, told him she loved him, and insisted he put himself into the hospital. She knew, we knew, he wouldn't. And yet we urged him. It was all we could do. By now the only advice, the only words of sympathy and love we could offer were to him stale and useless. He asked me to drive him to his own house. He would leave his car parked in the street in front of mine, pick it up some other time. I drove him home. I can't recall what we talked about. It wasn't important in itself. A little evasive chatter apropos of nothing, but significant of how our once comfortable feelings had changed. My diary of the day records, Sunday, March 19th, 1995. I stayed up all night trying to monitor Hugh, but failed to remain constantly awake. He damaged nothing in his frenetic moving from room to room, damaged only himself with the cocaine he had with him. How can I describe the deeply melancholy experience it was? He was docile but quite insane the whole night. I had dozed on the sofa and wakened to find him standing near me, staring down at me. He looked worried. He asked me if I was all right, and I replied that I was. "You were making terrible sounds, Pop," he told me, "and I thought maybe you were having an attack of some kind." "No, no," I assured him, "I'm fine. The sounds are just extravagant snores, come from overweight, bad breathing, and whatever." "Does Mom ever mention it?" "Oh, sure, plenty." "You better get a checkup, Pops." He was normal again. We went to the kitchen to make coffee, and Nancy and Angela soon joined us. The baby was still fast asleep. Hugh asked Angela to come home with him, but she calmly refused. She told him firmly, patiently, that he had to commit himself indefinitely to a cure facility. He argued bitterly, though quietly, that all he needed was a change in our attitudes. We weren't helping him, standing by him, and making life comfortable again. He was now coming down, the last few steps from the coke high, and getting into the mean, sober, rotten phase. His attempts to put Angela and us on the defensive, blaming us for his sad, stupid life, were absurd and became vile. I drove him home. He asked me if I wanted to come in, and I said no. I had to get back to take care of some things. He was a lonely figure crossing the street, finding a key, raising his hand in a small wave. But I was not moved to get out of the car and follow him in. Angela and Sean were still at our house at about 9 p.m. Hugh, having again gotten himself wholly coke-toxic, was phoning us idiotically at 11:45 p.m. We pulled the plugs on the phone. Monday, March 20th, 1995. No change. Hugh is home alone, inducing big mood swings with cocaine and booze and putting himself beyond the reach of any rational appeal. Angela is looking for a rental house. Wants to get away from him. Wednesday, March 22nd, 1995. When Hugh next called, I told him I was going to tape him. I may believe I had taped him all day. And this seemed to make him speak more carefully. No blue language, that is, but no less crazily than before. He charges Angela with infidelity to keep the talk on her and on us in order to keep it off himself. I calmly insist on talking to him only about himself and cocaine, nothing else. Cocaine and what it is doing to him. And he loses no time in hanging up with a curse. 10 minutes later, he's ringing our lines again. We all take turns talking to him. His mother is the most patient with him, but Angela is very patient with him, too. How she suffers it all, I don't know, but, of course, she loves him. Sunday, March 26th. We spoke to Hugh at home at about 9 p.m. He renewed his demand that Angela and Sean come home and blamed me for letting them stay with me, keeping him and his family apart. He wasn't loud and crazy, but his mind was fuzzy. We pray for him. Nancy is frequently in tears over him these days, hoping he'll fight free of this, that we all won't lose him in it. Monday, March 27th. A deluge of dirt hit the Pacific Coast Highway near Chautauqua. Angela, caught in town, couldn't get back here to Broad Beach till 7:30 p.m. She talked to Hugh by phone and found him quite gone again on cocaine. Tuesday, March 28th, 1995. Hugh killed himself at home at about 4 p.m. On that last day I saw my son, I have wondered at times remorsefully what might have happened if I had gone into the house with him. Would we have sat down and, as usual, avoided looking directly at one another and tried to find something to talk about until he fidgeted and chafed and looked a little wild-eyed again and said, "Pops, I think I'll get into bed for some sleep." And I would have said, "Go ahead, son, you need some." We would have suddenly tightly hugged and kissed each other. I would have left knowing that sleep was truly what he needed, but that what he really wanted was to make a phone call. And I would have lurked in my car at the head of the street to observe the arrival of the pusher. Why? I don't know why. What would I have done? Attack him? Take the .38 automatic out of the door pocket? Threaten him with it? Provoke him to some action that would compel me to shoot him? I wouldn't have required much provocation. I would have shot him. Dwelling on the last 12 hours with my boy, I could not make my mind work sanely. My unrelenting fantasy was of killing the pusher, a sign, no doubt, of derangement. I wondered whether this wasn't some kind of incipient dementia. I had had disturbing intimations of losing Hugh. I had been recalling incidents, Nancy and Angela seeing him collapse into unconsciousness and calling 911, tall, powerful Preston Hagman, my friend Larry's son and a friend of Hugh's from childhood, restraining Hugh while others begged him to go back into a hospital, his shouting coke-crazy imprecations at me in a sheriff's jail in Georgia. And I had been confusing the real scenes with remembered dreams. The mix had always resolved itself into a single horror, someone telling me of the death of my son. So that long before his death, because I knew he was going to die, I wanted violent revenge on whoever was bringing death to him. I could see only evil in the pusher. Hugh had said, "Yeah, he's not too bad a guy," when I once asked sourly, "What kind of a human being is he, son?"
Nobody, according to Hugh, was too bad a guy.
What would the people who loved the pusher say? Such people existed. I saw them later in a courtroom. What could they see in him, this creature whom I thought of as a deliberate killer? They saw, they must have seen, a dear, loving young man, a son, a brother, a sweetheart, for whom they would do anything in the world. Even if they knew what he was up to? Well, maybe they didn't know. Or knowing, were persuaded that what he was doing was no great sin, something he shouldn't be doing, of course, but nothing a friend or relative couldn't prevail on him to stop doing. I, on the other hand, saw only a man who went willingly and happily into the drug trade in order to live well by selling deadly substances to the reckless and unwary. A man who worked at developing a reliable circle of helpless, high-spending addicts who were too mindless to be deterred by the prospect of an early death. What would such a man say of himself? The pusher's simple, complacent argument is that millions of people want his wares, which are merely lay prescriptions for turning depression into delight, and that in flouting the law he is providing products that are no worse than booze and should be just as legal. He sees our efforts to punish him as crazy. But wouldn't legalization hurt him? No. This criminal could always compete successfully with legal retailers, both in price and incidental services, like round-the-clock delivery. As the father of a victim of marijuana, amphetamines, cocaine, heroin, all items offered on the pusher's menu, I ask first and foremost how legalization would diminish for us the threat of a spreading nationwide disease. By making the poison easier to acquire, how does legalization help the addicted self-poisoner? Returning to this fellow Harry, I shall never forget him somberly staring at me when I was on the witness stand under attack by his lawyer, twisting his head about in dismay at my persecution of him, though it was he who was suing me for $10 million. His sad look may have been just an inapt pose for the eyes of the jury, but I could not be sure that it wasn't a genuine, however skewed, emotional response. His lawyer characterized him as the little guy, whose rights were being trampled by a big guy. The big guy, he pointed at me, wanted to shift blame for his son's suicide away from himself, the indifferent father who was responsible for it. The lawyer, as palpable a knave as ever I did see, told the jury that his case was really about championing the cause of the little guy. He implored the jury of little guys to be the righteous voice of one of their own. But the jury's unanimous, resounding reply was that they rejected any identification with this particular little guy. I learned later when I met the jury that, in fact, they cared as much for him as for a roach. Now, here I am, nearly at the end of my memoir. I began by telling you why I think I'm out of here, out of the theater. So in closing, I think it's time I tell you why I was in here, in the theater in the first place. What brought you to acting? The question had been often asked, and I repeated on this occasion an answer I had often given, something about realizing romantic fantasies. But this interviewer snapped shut his steno pad and said, "Well, let's do something better with our morning, shall we?" I deserved the snide rejoinder. I had not even been looking at him. It was a perfect spring morning, and we were on the terrace of the Carlton Hotel in Cannes, and the vista of boulevard and boats and sea was too distracting. "It's not that I mind reporting twaddle," he said with a sour little smile. "The readers love it, silly darlings, but I was told you were the kind of person who might want to give me something fresh." I felt chastened. I had come late to the interview and must have seemed rudely uncaring. I said, "Maybe you could think of something fresh for me." I was trying to be quite sincere, but he popped to his feet looking like an irritated little English thrush and retorted, "Maybe you could think of something yourself."
Ring me up when you do.
Later on, Nancy advised, next time you're asked what brought you to it, just recall your favorite Jimmy Durante line. Everybody wants to get into the act.
Most people do feel the urge to entertain, sing a song at the parlor piano, tell a joke at the office, play in a skit at the club. When we evoke merriment around us, we enjoy deep satisfaction. But then, in responding to this urge to entertain, some of us discover that we want to do little else. We are compelled to try to wring a living out of performing. In brief, professional acting is a harmless compulsion gone haywire. I have heard show business characterized as a refuge for childlike persons in flight from all things harsh and real. Actors are children, was the benign judgment of the old movie tycoons, especially when they were contemplating something malignant. May I recall one pertinent incident from the long ago, when I had no idea of acting for a living, but when I began to suspect that I was neurotic? I recall incidents from my past, from key lines like, "Do you know who you are?" and "What brought you to acting?" There are many key lines. Here is one. "You're not proud you're Irish?" That key line, a very angry question, was shot at me by a fellow with orange hair and little pale eyes. He had mentioned that he was a stevedore, and he was a formidable specimen, but something told me he was yellow under his pink skin. I said, "Why should I be proud? My derivation has nothing to do with me. Know what I mean?" This, of course, was a mistake. It took me years to realize that nearly everyone in the world rejects the light of logic. But this was before my time of realization. It was 1943, a year of war. The locale was Hoboken, New Jersey. My ship, a freighter, was lying at a Hudson River pier. It had offered a card game, idle conversation, books, or simple solitude. But I, being 19 and energetic at night, had opted for livelier pleasures ashore, which I imagined could be found at a bar named Kelly's. I met there a girl who said she was pure Estonian. Her father, she told me, seemed pleased that the Russians were beating back the Germans, but her mother wanted Hitler to win. The girl was confused. She said she didn't like going to bars, but what was she to do? She hated the quarreling at home. She was afraid of her mother, so was I, on hearsay alone. Naturally, she was lonely, she said. This promising turn of conversation was interrupted by the Celt previously described, who was on my right at the bar. He leaned in and asked whether he had not seen my Irish face before. I said probably not. He proceeded unencouraged to expatiate on racial distinctiveness, the ubiquitous Irish face, the Irish character, and finally, Irish pride. My response, which I have already recalled, made him glare ominously, and yet I went on. "I hate pride, but if I were going to be proud of anything, it would have to be something I'd done myself. Anything else makes no sense, and race pride is kind of stupid, I think. You see what I mean?" He shook his head as though sadly puzzled. With a smile and shrug, he turned away, apparently at a loss to say more. But he suddenly whirled back and walloped me on the jaw, knocking me off my bar stool. When I raised my face from the tiles, the pink man was moving quickly toward the front door. I got up and lurched after him. Unfriendly drinkers left their stools and grabbed me by the neck and arms, but I managed to gain the street, where I spied Danny Boy rounding a corner at a fast clip. My only hope of vengeance was to tempt him back, and so with all the breath I had left, I roared something vile at him about what he could do to himself and for good measure to all the Irish wherever they were. He was out of earshot. But a passerby at close range, hearing me very clearly, stepped right over and walloped me on the jaw once again. That was the finisher. I went down and out. A cop drove up, got out of his car, revived me, and hauled me to my feet. From the doorway of Kelly's, the passerby yelled, "My mother came from Ireland, you louse!" The cop helped me to his car and gave me a lift to the pier. That was Hoboken. The wages of pedantry is pain.
In those days I was a provocateur. I could have provoked violence at the Trappist Abbey. I was for years a chronic and infuriating arguifier, though contentiousness was not a family trait. We had plenty of argument within doors, but all agreed that the guiding rule of life outside was tact. I was the only deviant. I remember a moment at the dining room table. I was in my teens when my grandfather bawled at me, "God damn it, don't be always straightening people out. Let them think whatever bloody rot makes them feel good and say nothing." What was it about me, anyway? A friend of boyhood in Forest Hills, Gerald Briggs, once told me, "It's just that you've always had a big mouth." No doubt. The big mouth was the consequence of a neurotic notion that I ought to straighten people out, and worse still, that people everywhere were anxious for me to do so. But all it did for me was put me in danger. I escaped danger by going into the theater. In other words, danger drove me to the safety of the theater. It was neuroticism that caused the danger. What caused the neuroticism, I shall probably never know. Have I changed with the passing years? No. I do talk less because the sound of my voice saying over and over the things I said years ago embarrasses and depresses me. Why do I say the same things over and over? Because I've never changed my opinions about anything. Thus, the interview begun on the terrace in Cannes comes finally to a finish. The irritable little thrush of an interviewer, if he hears all this, has at least a thoughtful answer to his question. Though I see now that the fresh angle has still eluded me. There's nothing really fresh about neurosis.
I Think I'm Outta Here, a memoir of all my families, was written and read by Carol O'Connor. It was abridged for audio by George Truitt. The recording engineer was Jocelyn Gonzalez, with editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, technical director. The mix engineer was Rick Bradley. The associate producer was Florence Burrow Adams. I Think I'm Outta Here was produced and directed by Elisa Shokoff. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. I Think I'm Outta Here is also available in hardcover from Simon & Schuster.